Okay. Good afternoon. I'm opening up the Senate Environment and Natural Resources Committee for Monday, April 8th. And we're going to start off actually with the work sessions while we're waiting for the governor to show up. I'll go ahead and open up a work session on Senate Bill 117. Beth, if you can remind the committee about the amendments.
Madam Chair and committee members, so in front of you, you have Senate Bill 117. There's a no revenue impact on the Dash 5 and a minimal fiscal impact. No statement was issued. The amendment for that you're looking at, Dash 5, it replaces the measure which removes the pilot project designation from approved beverage container redemption centers, requires the commission to base convenience zone on proposals submitted by the center to the greatest extent possible. It increases the first convenience zone to a radius of not more than 2 miles around the center, and the second zone to not more than 3.5 miles around the center, and it clarifies the authority for the center to charge costs of participation to dealers that occupy a space of 5,000 or more square feet. It requires the commission to submit a report to the legislature no later than March 1st of each odd number year with certain information.
Thank you, Beth, and thank you for working on this amendment. My understanding, this is a consensus amendment.
My understanding is that's correct, and there's people in the audience. If you
I'm seeing nodding of heads, so I will ask if either of the members would like any of the work group members to come up and talk about it.
I think I would just talk about the consensus. Okay. Over here.
So we'll have Marge and Sean. I don't think DEQ is in, or AOR is in the room, but I have received emails from them that they are fine with it. But if you want to put a few words on the record, we'd appreciate that. Yep. And you also talk fast because the governor just walked in.
and don't say anything about him.
Yeah.
Madam Chair and members, I'm Marge Cafori representing OBRC.
Yeah, Sean Miller representing the Northwest Grocery Association, and we are in support of the Dash 5 amendments. This does take the pilot project and allows us to work this statewide, and there was just several provisions in here on the reporting mechanism that I know Senator Olson and Senator Dingfelder worked on, and so happy to answer any questions, but again, consensus among the agencies, DEQ, OLCC, and the industry, and this will allow us to move forward. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Great, thank you. And I know Senator Olson, by the way, is out ill today and cannot be here, and Senator Bates is taking care of patients, but I know Senator Olson, I'll thank him in absentia that I appreciated the work that he did on this and appreciated the work that you all did working together with the committee administrator and DEQ and the Association of Oregon Recyclers. Thank you.
Chair Dingfelder, yeah. I move to adopt the Dash 5 amendments.
Senator Haas moves to adopt the Dash 5 amendments dated 4-2-2013. Is there any discussion? Are there any objections? Seeing none, the amendment is adopted.
Chair Dingfelder, I move Senate Bill 117 as amended to the floor of the Oregon State Senate with the due pass recommendation.
Okay, Senator Haas moves Senate Bill 117 as amended with the Dash 5s to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? The clerk will call the roll, please. Excused.
Aye.
Aye.
Vice Chair Olson.
Excused. Aye. With that, the motion carries and or passes. Senator Haas, would you like to carry this since you worked on the original bottle bill expansion? Great. Okay, so noted for the record, Senator Haas will carry that. We'll go ahead and close the work session on Senate Bill 117. We'll go ahead and open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 830. And Beth, if you can give us an overview, please.
Madam Chair and committee members, Senate Bill 830 for the revenue impact statement and a fiscal impact statement have been issued on the bill, and they are in your packets and going up on OLS as we speak if they're not already there. Repeals the provisions related to taking food fish by fixed fishing gear or seines. It directs the State Department of Fish and Wildlife to establish and implement a Columbia Fisheries Transition Program, and it establishes a Columbia River Fisheries Enhancement Fund and continuously appropriates that fund to the Commission to implement measures that enhance fisheries. Authorize the Commission to establish by rule an annual Columbia Basin Salmon, Steelhead, and Sturgeon Recreational Fishing Endorsement Fee not to exceed $9.50.
Okay, thank you. Governor, would you like to come up? And Brett, are you going to accompany him? And Senator Girard, would you like to come up as well? I think we have three seats. Welcome, Senator. Sorry, we decided to go ahead and Governor with a work session while we were waiting, so apologize for you having to wait in the back.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, John Kitzhaber, Governor of the State of Oregon. I appreciate very much the opportunity to testify on Senate Bill 830. I would also like to thank Senator Girard and the other sponsors for bringing this bill forward, and particularly this bipartisan group that has recognized that it's time to move beyond rhetorical battles to try to find lasting and endurable solutions that advance the economy of both the North Coast and of both recreational and commercial fisheries, as well as balance the conservation values that are very, very important, I think, to this state. Senate Bill 830 includes needed statutory changes that are critical to the economic interests that are tied to Oregon fisheries and to Oregon fishing communities. The need for these statutory changes is driven not just by the fish management reforms that I asked the Oregon Fish and Wildlife Commission to consider, but also by the broader context in which those reforms take place. And I would ask you to consider that context, that larger context, as you discuss the particulars of this piece of legislation. Over the course of many legislative sessions, I can tell you dating back to at least 1979, this body has seen tensions between our recreational and commercial fishing interests, a battle that last year moved from the legislature to the ballot box. Ballot Measure 81 pitted those interests one against the other and proposed a total ban on gill nets in the lower Columbia River. I opposed that measure. I urged voters to reject that measure because I believe that the state's Fish and Wildlife Commission, rather than the ballot, is the appropriate venue to develop this kind of management policy, and also because I believe and I know, in fact, that both our commercial and recreational fisheries bring significant economic benefits to Oregon, and both are part of our culture and both are a part of our heritage. And it seemed to me that the provisions and measures in Ballot Measure 81 did not provide a balanced approach that recognized the importance of both of these industries to the fabric of our state and to the economy, particularly of the North Coast. So instead, I urged both the supporters and the opponents of Ballot Measure 81 to engage in an administrative pathway through the Oregon Fish and Wildlife Commission, where issues surrounding harvest allocation, gill nets, and alternative gear could be considered together, and where the Oregon approach could be coordinated with the approach of our neighbors across the river. I proposed a potential solution framework to the Fish and Wildlife Commission, and I asked them then to fill in the details using their own discretion. And essentially, that's exactly what the Fish and Wildlife Commission did, garnering significant public input over a several-month period. The rules that were adopted by the Fish and Wildlife Commission advance a policy vision that's based on a balanced approach, trying to balance the interests of the North Coast economy, of both the commercial and recreational fishing interests, as well as the threatened and endangered salmon species that migrate up the Columbia River. One of the promised outcomes, in fact, a central tenet of the outcome of these new rules is to advance a net gain economic benefit for both the commercial fishing interests and for our recreational fisheries. I just want you to know that I remain deeply committed to that policy outcome, and Senate Bill 830 is a key element in bringing about that win-win economic situation. I also want to say at this point that this is there's a four-year transition period with waypoints in which the progress can be monitored and opportunities and policies can be adjusted to make sure that we are on track to ensuring net economic gain for both of these fisheries. Senate Bill 830 addresses the statutory changes that are critical to move forward on alternative gear use in the main stem Columbia, that are critical to moving forward on enhancing off-channel commercial fisheries, that are critical to moving forward on optimizing economic benefits for both the commercial fishing industry and the recreational industry, and also ensuring that the commercial interests are not harmed, that in other words, that they are protected from undue harm during this four-year transition period. For these reforms to work, the forms that have been adopted by rule by the Fish and Wildlife Commission, it requires the support in the Capitol. It requires our support and our engagement. So I urge you to move this bill forward. I want to let you know that I intend to be personally engaged as this transition rolls out to make sure that the promise and the objective of a mutually economic beneficial outcome is in fact realized, and that we do protect the fisheries and the fishing communities of the lower Columbia River.
Thank you, Governor. Do you have time to stick around, or?
I can stick around for about 5 minutes, but I'm happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Okay, why don't we see if there's any questions for the governor? I think Senator Hansel has one.
Governor, thank you for coming. Are any of the provisions that were in ballot measure 81 now a part of 830?
One of the objectives of ballot measure 81 was to, I guess its overall objective was to eliminate the gillnet fishery in the lower Columbia. That is not the purpose here, but it is to move that off the main stem into considerably enhanced off-channel fisheries, and then to provide the alternative, the option for alternative gear to be used by the commercial fleet in the mainstream. So they do both result in moving the gillnets off of the main stem, but I would argue this is a much more scientifically based and balanced approach that seeks to ensure the long-term viability and, in fact, enhancement of the commercial fisheries as well as the recreational fisheries.
How are the Native American fisheries or fishermen affected one way or the other by this?
They should not be affected. One of the tenets of my proposal and of the commission's rules was to honor the provisions of U.S. v. Oregon.
Thank you. Senator?
Yes, I'm Senator Fred Girod from District Number 9. First of all, I've been involved in this issue for a very long time, and I want to personally thank the governor and his staff for the leadership in this arena. It's just absolutely been stellar, and we wouldn't be to where we're at without his leadership. I just think that it's extremely important that we looked at all the problems that we've been having with fish in the past, and the cost to our system is monumental, not just to the sports fishing industry. And some people can view this as a turf battle between the sports fishermen and the gillnetters, but you need to look at the impacts that we've had on agriculture and even your power bill for two examples where wild fish have come as cost billions and billions of dollars. So Senate Bill 830 basically is the working part of what we need to do to implement the governor's vision, which most of you that have been around the building for a while, it's kind of based on the Safe for Salmon legislation that we had 2 years ago. There's four main parts. There's one that you see that we create a transition fund. That transition fund is to help the gillnetters do a transition to seine nets, which is part of the selective harvest that we're trying to promote. What we're trying to do is trying to reduce as much as we can the wild fish kill that exists with gillnets. Number two is the Fish Enhancement Fund. This fund will help place fish in the safe areas, which Young's Bay is the best example that we have, so that increased hatchery production in those areas will increase yield in those areas for gillnetters and should reduce the amount of negative cost allocation that would go to them. The third would be a fee change to pay for the Fish Enhancement Fund. That's going to be $9.50. Now, no one wants to pay an additional fee of $9.50, but the fishing industry, the sports fishing industry, has stood firm that this is something that they're willing to step up to the plate and do because they believe that this plan has merit, and that for sports fishing in particular, it'll mean a bigger allotment for them, a longer season. And make the story short, we spend a lot of money when we go out fishing in gear, tackle, boats, and whatever. We want the highest probability that we can catch a fish. I think that this policy will do that. The fourth part of it is allowing for alternative gear. In the law right now, it doesn't allow for seine nets. This will allow for seine nets and other nets to be used as an alternative to gill nets. So, but back to the $9.50, I do need to make one point. That is that this bill needed to have a poison pill in it, that this would not go into effect unless the commission made the changes that it has already made, or if the courts change the commission rulings or the commission changes the rulings that it has, that the $9.50 does not go into effect. That's the intent of this bill. We try to get a poison pill in there, but you can't put a poison pill in if it has anything to do with the commission. We can only do it as far as the state goes. So that's the intent. I think that's important to put in there. As far as the ballot measure goes, to answer a little bit of what Senator Hansel said, we had a lot of different choices when we moved forward with the ballot measure, and one was a Safe for Salmon, but we were not comfortable at all that it would fit the one item requirement that is required for a ballot measure. It's very complex, and so we went with something that would have just made seine nets mandatory and with no gill nets. I think this is by far a more balanced approach that the governor has offered, and that's the reason that you see myself and others have backed him on this approach.
Thank you.
Any questions at all?
Did you want to add anything, Brett?
Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee, no, thank you.
Okay. Any questions for the senator?
I'm not sure the connection between the Federal Fishery Administration or whatever it's called and the state. If we're approving new varieties of catch, or do they have to approve it also? And if so, have they? Or what's the connection?
I think Fish and Wildlife's coming up behind us, and I think that'd be an appropriate question for them. But I don't think that that's a problem. These are hatchery fish that we have excess we have excess production that's available for hatcheries. So it's something that we're already doing, and the numbers I don't think will matter. But Bill, Senator Hansel, I would ask them directly. I'm not 100% sure of that.
We do have Fish and Wildlife coming up afterwards.
I might, Madam Chair, just a couple of points. So part of this, part of the effort to make this work involves 250,000 more spring Chinook, a hatchery Chinook, 1 million coho, and 250,000 a select area bright fall Chinook. So there's a lot of fish being programmed to come to these off-channel areas. And I just, if I might just say that in this transition period, we would allow the continued use of gill nets in the main stem for this fishery. We would only partially shift the mainstream priority off-channel, and we'd take steps to increase the commercial harvest, which I just mentioned. And then the other very, very important thing is that we're required to do, as a part of this, a regular review to see whether the targets, enough fish are returning to those off-channel areas to make sure that the harvest for the commercial fishery is what we hoped it would be. And if it isn't, then we need to assess why that is and make adjustments. So the idea here and the intent here is, again, to get a net economic win, gain for both the commercial and recreational fisheries.
Ask the Governor one more question.
Follow-up.
Governor, in your work with Washington, are they with us on this, or are they still going to be able to use gill nets on the Washington side?
No, we've coordinated with the Washington Commission. I've also been in communication with Governor Inslee on this, so we are aligned.
Good. And I think you'll hear more from the department on that, because I'll plan to ask them that as well.
Thank you.
Great. Thank you very much.
Thank you,
Governor, for taking time out of your busy schedule to come visit with us today. Okay, next up, we will call up the Department of Fish and Wildlife. We have the director here, and Ed Bowles is from the Fish Division. Welcome, gentlemen.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair.
I just spent all the last 2 hours with you hearing on your budget, and now I have to...
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Roy Elliker, the director of the Oregon Department in Fish and Wildlife. On my left, Ed Bowles, on special assignment to the director's office for Columbia River issues. Madam Chair, I have a short two-page statement. I really just want to cover the first three elements there. I know there's the senators and the committee has a number of questions, and I know you have a lot of people to testify. So, again, Senate Bill 830 has three primary elements. First, repeals existing prohibitions of fixed fishing gear and seines for commercial fisheries and allows the commission the power to authorize different kinds of fixed fishing gear and seines as we test those and those come online, hopefully. Second, establishes a transition fund to purpose of aiding commercial fishers during that period of the transition. and avoiding economic harm associated with the new change in gear and shifting allocations of fish. And third, establishes an enhancement fund. Senator Girard explained that and about the poison pill provision in that. But essentially, Madam Chair, it's short testimony, and the governor, essentially, and I want to thank him again for his personal leadership on this issue for us and my commission. Very much appreciated. I think with that, I'll end my prepared testimony. I know there's a number of questions that we can touch upon for the committee.
Okay. Did you want to add anything, Ed, or you're just here to answer questions?
Chair Dingfelder, I'm just here to answer questions.
Well, I will reiterate the question that we heard from Senator Hansel about the timing of and the alignment of this, both with the state of Washington regulations and any federal catch regulations or allocations.
Chair Dingfelder, the actual process to develop the commission rules was done jointly with the state of Washington. So it was a joint commission process that included a work group that had three commissioners from each. And so we've walked hand in hand with Washington throughout this process. Our commission adopted their rules at their December commission meeting, and the state of Washington adopted a policy that is complementary to this in most every way. At their January meeting, and so they are on the similar, basically the same track. And then the river, of course, is managed primarily real time through the Joint Columbia River Compact, which is Director Elliker and from Oregon and Director Anderson from Washington. Their delegates do the real time management. So even that, the day to day, is done jointly with the two states. I think one of the other questions that came up was relative to the authorizations from the federal government. In this case, it would be NOAA Fisheries for that. And they give kind of the approvals for all of our fisheries through consultations that we do with them. And so any new fisheries that are implemented would need to get approval. They basically look at things relative to the impacts. And so, given that we are not increasing impacts on targeted fisheries, we do not anticipate a problem with that whatsoever. In getting those approvals, it would just be a different gear type. We already have the authorization to do the test fisheries and the pilot research fisheries, looking at the seines, beach seines, and purse seines already approved through the federal government.
That answer your question, Senator?
Yes.
Any other questions? And as far as timing, the implementation times, so those align with the state of Washington?
Chair Dingfelder, yes. We are aligned with the state of Washington on that, with several, as the governor mentioned, several critical touch points. And in fact, our commission reiterated they wanted annual check-ins on this beginning the end of this first year. For adaptive management to make sure we are on track with the expectations that were lined out.
Okay. Any other questions, Senator?
Is there going to be a conservation benefit by moving the gill nets off the mainstream between the hatchery and the wild salmon from your point of view?
Chair Dingfelder, Senator Hansel, the overall package of this includes several elements. Part of it is, of course, the allocation shift. Another is the enhancement of fish in the off-channel areas, the hatchery fish. And the other is the development of alternative gears to allow the commercial fishery to maintain a presence in the main stem, targeting fisheries primarily coho and fall chinook, okay? Under those two aspects, Senator, the coho and the fall chinook, there will be, we believe, a quite strong conservation benefit because those will be using gears that allow the commercial fleet to access far more hatchery fish with the same or fewer impacts to wild fish because they'll be able to more readily sort those fish. And so those two aspects will provide tangible conservation benefits. This element was extremely important to the state of Washington because they, under their Lower River Recovery Plan for wild fall Chinook, they're called Tule Chinook, were under a lot of criticism that too many of the hatchery fish escape to the spawning grounds in the Lower River. And this will allow a lot of those hatchery fish to be intercepted by the commercial fishermen prior to reaching those spawning grounds and reduce the conservation risk. So, yes.
I do a follow-up. Have you reached out to the commercial fishermen in the development of this plan? And if so, what has been their reaction to it?
Chair Dingfelder and Senator Hansel, as I mentioned earlier, the process, once we received a request to consider this by the governor last August, we embarked on a very ambitious process, but it included not only Washington and Oregon commissioners on a working group, but advisors to that working group, and those included sectors for both the commercial and the sport sectors, as well as a representative of the Lower River counties from Clatsop County, and so it was the county chair for that. And so those advisors attended all the meetings, provided input throughout that process, the work group process, and then we also had input throughout our separate commission process for two meetings in November and December. Very lengthy, full, the last one was a full day meeting and heard very much from the commercial interest at that was to our commissioners. So they have been involved throughout this process relative to the commission rulemaking, if that was your question, Senator, relative to the rulemaking.
Well, as a two-point, follow-up. There, you know, the fact that they were involved, what, are they supportive of this plan to your knowledge? Or not?
Senator Dingfelder and Senator Hansel, I think you'll hear, I think you're going to have some testimony, and I really would prefer not to characterize exactly with their beliefs, but I will tell you that throughout the process, I have not heard where they are on the Senate bill, but I know that throughout the process, they have been extremely concerned about primarily the sense of shouldering much of the uncertainty related to implementing this plan. Would the fish releases in the off-channel areas actually take place? Would the off-channel areas be large enough to accommodate the fleet? Would the development of alternative gears actually work out in an economical way? And would their economics actually be improved in the long term? These are all very legitimate concerns, part of the key uncertainties of this plan, and they are why we have committed to a transition period where gill nets are allowed through that transition period to make sure we get this right as we move forward with check-in points under that adaptive management where each commission, Washington and Oregon, will be tracking this very closely to try to get towards, as the governor characterized, somewhat of a win-win for both sectors on this.
All right. Thank you very much, gentlemen. If we have additional questions, you may want to hang out in the back. We do have a lot of people signed up for this bill and for the next bill, so I'm going to just make an announcement. We have the clock here. I'm hoping we don't have to use it, but I'm going to ask people, if you have a written testimony, please do not read it, because we can read it. We have it here, or we have it on the computer. If you can summarize and state the key points, it's really helpful for us, because we want to make sure we have enough time before the committee adjourns. With that, I will call up, we have Paul Lumley from CRITFIC. Paul, why don't you come up? I know, but I'm calling the tribes up first. Thank you for coming here today. I know Kat Brigham couldn't be here from the Umatilla, but appreciate the fact that you could be here, and I know that she was going to submit something, hopefully in writing or anyway.
Thank you, Chair Dingfelder. Yes, Catherine Brigham is the chair.
And can you just state your name for the record, Paul?
Well, sure. My name is Paul Lumley. I'm the executive director of the Columbia River Intertribal Fish Commission. And Kat Brigham did want to come here and testify today, but because of the short notice and the long duration of her travel, she couldn't be here today. So she did complete a letter, though, and that's being handed out to you today, and I'll be reviewing the letter for you.
Here we go.
The Columbia River Intertribal Fish Commission represents the four tribes' fishery interests, Umatilla, Warm Springs, Nez Perce, and Yakima, for which I'm a citizen. And the letter outlines our reasons why we don't think that Senate Bill 830 is the appropriate course of action. Firstly, the voters of Oregon already considered this and resoundingly rejected it, and it's not the first time that measures like this have been proposed to the Oregon voters, and this most recent one was rejected by the voters, and so we don't think for that reason it's appropriate to be reconsidering that here. But also we have technical issues and serious policy concerns about this proposed legislation. Primarily, restructuring the gillnet fishery is not about saving any fish. And you'd heard from previous testimony here just a few minutes ago that it's targeted to as a fish conservation measure, but it does not save fish. It just moves fish caught from one category into another, that is caught from gillnets to the sport fishing industry. And it also is a major distraction, has been a major distraction of all the parties, when we should actually be working on abundance. We should be working towards rebuilding salmon runs, not arguing over who gets to catch the scarce few fish that are remaining in the river. And despite what you'd heard from the governor, and with all due respect to him, there are effects on our tribal fishery with this proposal. There are a lot more hatchery fish that will be harvested in the Low River, which changes the allocation. And that's different than what we signed up for when we signed on to the USV-Oregon Management Agreement. For example, if the Low River starts catching a lot more hatchery fish and we fish after them and geographically behind them, so we'll have less hatchery fish to catch and our harvest rate on wild fish will be higher. So it does change some of the expectations of when we signed on to that management agreement in 2008. I have to express a little bit of frustration about the timeliness of this hearing. It was very short notice. This legislation is being pushed through very quickly, and it appears to be using some kind of an emergency provision so that it would be implemented as soon as it's voted upon, and we don't see any reason why there needs to be an emergency. We don't see anything in here regarding preservation of public peace, health, and safety. So we're questioning the emergency nature of this as well. There's a couple of items in there about these funds that we have questions and concerns about, in particular the Columbia River Fisheries Enhancement Fund. There's some ambiguity associated with that, and we're concerned about potentially a waste of money. And when I did talk to Catherine Brigham Friday afternoon, she had already heard from some sport fishers on the east side of the Cascades in her area, and they were questioning why they should be paying a fee to resolve a fishing dispute in the lower Columbia River. So they didn't think that was a very good deal for them, and she wanted me to express that. There's also this Columbia River Transition Fund. Establishes a fund, although there's no funds currently dedicated to it. And so there's some question about how that will be played out. Hooking mortality has been a long problem for the tribes. We don't see any real adequate and credible technical analysis of fish that are caught and released, sometimes on multiple occasions. There is potentially a lot more mortality here on wild fish than people are willing to talk about, at least what we heard from the previous speakers. The incentives for good productivity of wild fish is also included here. These MARC selected fisheries, their incentive is to have lower numbers of wild fish and higher numbers of hatchery fish in order for this scheme to work. And when you start getting a lot more wild fish back and less hatchery fish, then that doesn't work. And so there's a strong incentive here to maintain fisheries where you have a scarcity of wild fish and an extreme abundance of hatchery fish. And this proposal, which is now written into the draft of Senate Bill 830, promotes that failed scheme. It's already been tried. It's been tried with the steelhead. Steelhead were mass marked, and there's been a mark selected fisheries on that run of fish since the 1980s. And those fish are listed under the Endangered Species Act. So it doesn't work. It doesn't save fish. And I'm disappointed to hear from the previous speakers that they think that these kinds of fishing techniques actually save fish. They don't. In fact, if you look at what the tribes are doing, and they're focusing on abundance, And we see from the Nez Perce Tribe Snake River Program where we went from a few thousand fish right after they were listed to now over 40,000. And there's a big number of those are naturally spawning fish. These are the kind of programs that we'd like to see promoted. When we go back and talk to Congress about the lack of hatchery funding, we hear from them that they expect these programs out here to be doing more than just providing a put-and-take fishery. They want to see naturally spawning fish being improved by these programs, not harmed. And so this kind of a proposal that we're hearing in Senate Bill 830 does not promote recovery, does not promote abundance of wild fish or naturally spawning fish. So, and it's not what Congress expects. Finally, I would like to express some disappointment with the state of Oregon and not working directly with the tribes. Ever since this proposal was initiated, there's been a distinct avoidance of government-to-government relations, and there's been even avoidance of this issue within the USB Oregon processes. And so if we're going to be instituting major changes in fish allocation in the lower Columbia River, we would think that they would want to talk to the tribes because we are affected, and we're also signatories of the USB Oregon Management Agreement. So with that, I'd just like to conclude by stating again that the tribes are very interested in working with everybody on anybody who wants to work with us on rebuilding naturally spawning runs. We don't see fighting over scarcity as the way to do that. It takes partnership, and I would very much like to see this issue be put behind us so we can move forward and rebuild salmon runs for everyone's benefit. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony, Paul. Any questions, Mr. Lumley? Thank you for coming here today.
You're
welcome.
Appreciate
it. Okay, next up I will call Bruce Pauley, Liz Hamilton, and Bob Reese. Okay, somebody get started because we're really short on time. So, Bob, why don't you go first?
Good afternoon. Chair Dingvelder, members of the committee. My name is Bob Reese. I'm president of the Northwest Guides and Anglers Association, representing over 30 Columbia River guides and charters, as well as thousands of avid sport anglers, both resident and non-resident, that participate in the Northwest's most popular outdoor engine. We fully endorse Senate Bill 830 as a vital step forward for a long-anticipated opportunity for the sport fishing industry to grow jobs. For decades, the guide and charter industry has been plagued with emergency closures, which not only cripple our ability to realize an economic boost in the small rural towns that we operate in, but gives our customers and Oregon's visitors the impression that we don't know how to run our state's business and we're closed to sport fishing. Those visitors end up taking their business elsewhere. One unique and very Oregon feature of this bill is that it's a win-win for both important regional stakeholders in this conversation. The commercial and sport fleets will both benefit from the passage of this bill, and for the first time in my memory, stakeholders that are being asked to help foot the bill for this initiative will feel that they have received a generous return for their investment. With commercial fishing jobs in rural Oregon more secure than ever before, and sport fishing opportunity more prevalent than ever before, a greater transfer of wealth from urban to rural communities will be exercised on behalf of one of Oregon's most precious resources, our salmon. And speaking of transfer, it's important to bring to light that sport anglers have already endured the transfer of hundreds of thousands of juvenile salmon from inland sport fisheries in the Willamette and Sandy River basins to Young's Bay in Oregon, where most of Oregon's sport fishing fleet will not have access to them. Thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of Senate Bill 830. In our view, this is a jobs bill that is good for salmon and good for Oregon.
Welcome.
Chair Dingfelter, members of the committee, my name is Liz Hamilton. I have the good fortune of serving as the Executive Director for Northwest Sport Fishing Industry Association, and we thank you for the opportunity to testify today in support of Senate Bill 830. The NSIA is a trade organization formed in 1993 representing hundreds of businesses and thousands of family wage jobs consisting of manufacturers, manufacturers reps, wholesalers, retailers, boat builders, so dealers, guides, charters, sport fishing associations, and individuals who are all dedicated to the preservation, restoration, and enhancement of sport fisheries and the businesses that depend upon them. In 2011, there were 638,000 adult anglers who spent 5.6 million days fishing in Oregon, sustaining over 11,000 jobs. And I gave you the rest of the figures from that. I won't go over them right now. At NSIA, we've always used three principles to guide our policy direction: conservation, economics, and social equity. We believe Senate Bill 830 hits the mark on all of these principles, especially the economics. And for this, we have to thank the leadership and vision for Governor Kitzhaber, Senator Fred Girard, the staff at the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife, and the years of hard work between the Oregon and Washington Fish and Wildlife Commissions and their stakeholders. There have been numerous meetings both in Oregon and Washington and in Portland, as well as on the coast. And at the table, there has been abundant opportunity to comment from representatives of the sport and commercial fishing industries, but also members of the conservation and sport angling, and many, many, many times we've heard from the tribal community as well. This process has asked all of us to make sacrifices so we can enjoy a better future and better conservation for fishery resources. For example, you've already heard about the additional $9.50 to help implement these reforms. And believe me, it's our folks who sell those licenses. And so we have stepped forward because we know that in order for all of us to win, we all have to sacrifice together. ODF&W estimates that about 90,000 anglers will purchase this tag, and that's $1.6 million for the biennium. Given that a similar tag in Washington State has already sold 220,000, we think these figures are very, very conservative and understated. There is no doubt that this bill will create jobs. There are independent economists who believe so. The Pacific Fishery Management Council's figures substantiate this, and the Columbia River Fiscal Impact Advisory Committee adopted this statement of fact. The fiscal estimates the annual ex-vessel revenues of the Columbia River salmon landings will increase by about 20% during the interim and more in the long term. The PFMC estimates that this will be upwards of $1.43 million. By any yardstick, the measures that adopted by the Oregon and Washington commissions and embodied in this bill will create better economics and better conservation of Columbia River fisheries. And that's so Oregon. We are the intersection of great natural resources and a great economy. This is welcome news, though, to our industry, because we've seen stagnant growth over the last few years. And the fiscal shows that we will be seeing increases between 4.6 and 7.7 million. And again, we think if we work with the departments closer on crafting better seasons, these figures are going to be conservative. But finally, the most important part of this when we get to fairness and social equity is that the enhancement of the safe areas and the transitionary funding for the protection of the commercial industry. This includes building additional net pens and moving hatchery fish to those net pens, et cetera. We also are going to help buy additional Oregon State Police presence on the Columbia River and nearby counties. And given past cuts to OSP, I think we all should be excited about that. This isn't just about Oregon, though. It's a multi-state process and years of bi-state hearings that have included the Washington Commission, a commission that voted unanimously to support the direction that Oregon is headed. So we've made our promises now, and we are here to keep our part of the promises made. Thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you. Mr. Pollard.
Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee, I will respect your request to keep things just as brief as possible. But my name is, for the record, my name is Bruce Polly from Coastal Conservation Association of Oregon. I'm from Sherwood, Oregon. Senate Bill 830 finally legitimizes some needed reforms that have taken decades to work on in both Oregon and Washington. Senator Hansel asked earlier if these seine nets that this bill would allow to be used are currently legal to be used in the joint waters. They're currently legal in Washington, and there is plans in place to go forward. The bi-state process that was worked out over last year set up the transition period that the governor talked about earlier, and that is all in plan. This bill basically catches us up with Washington on both the allowance of the gear and also the setup of the fee. And in order to transition this, and as my associates have said up here, sport fishermen are shouldering that fee willingly to do the right thing for the fish and for the fisheries. One of the points that I wanted to make, this conversation that I've heard before about how this is not a conservation issue, The U.S. government set up a group called the Hatchery Scientific Review Group, where independent fisheries scientists were tasked with finding out what is wrong with salmon recovery in the Northwest. Where is all these billions of dollars going into, and what is the result we're getting for that? In a summation of the HSRG findings, they found that if selective commercial harvest was utilized, that we could double our investments in hatchery, hydro, and habitat that we've put into the Northwest. The ability to catch a hatchery fish and release a wild fish unharmed is critical to the recovery of salmon. This bill allows us to use that gear to make that possible. The gear has been used and tested in the Columbia River by both DFWs, Washington and Oregon, for the past 4 years. It's ready to be used, and it's time that we look at a way to harvest fish in Oregon without the use of a gill net. That's a real summation of my points. This is a bi-state agreement. It's a bipartisan agreement. It's supported by both governors in both states, and it's supported by both DFWs. And we would urge your support for the bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for any of these panelists? Thank you very much for coming here today and sharing your testimony. I have B.G. Ellerston and Trey Karskaden. I can never say your name, Trey, after all these years. Bob Olson, and then Tom Wolf. Where's Tom? Tom and Bob? Bob not here?
I'm here.
Okay, you guys come on up, because we're going to move this along. Yep. Welcome.
Thanks very much. Good to see you, Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee. As the governor, in his testimony, had indicated, this has been going on for a long time, and I've been a part of that. I was a sophomore in college when I started coming to this building on this issue. I'm 54 years old now, and I'm glad to see that maybe we're going to have some finality and move this forward. I live in Tualatin. My name is Trey Karskaden with the Northwest Sport Fishing Industry Association. I make my full-time living in the sport fishing industry. My company, which is an advertising agency, represents some of the biggest names in sport fishing. But I'm not here on their behalf. I'm here because I'm an Oregonian. I'm a fifth-generation Oregonian. My family settled here when this was a territory, and I think this is good for Oregon. It puts this acrimony behind us between the conflict that's been allowed to persist for too long. We've got some serious skin in the game with Senate Bill 830 by ponying up 950 an angler to fish the Columbia River for salmon. We're finding a way to make it as easy as possible on the commercial community. In this transition, we recognize their desire for certainty, and frankly, in fishing, there's very little certainty. We'd love to see the same kind of certainty when we hit the river as well, but we understand. And so we're supporting Senate Bill 830 for that reason. In a nutshell, we're forfeiting and allowing to forfeit every year tens of millions of dollars of economic opportunity by not opening up this river and encouraging tourism. And really the losers, not only the sport fishing industry loses, but those lower river communities lose as well. They stand to benefit mightily, enormously from this change in policy. This will pour millions and millions of dollars into these lower river communities each year with the opening of these seasons. In just a couple of years, we're going to see a return of roughly 150,000 summer Chinook as a result of increased hatchery production in the upper river that will bring people to our right into our backyard every summer to fish through the summer and into Buoy 10. We see a vision that's similar to where the governor's at, and we very much appreciate his support. Also very much appreciate you hearing this bill, hopefully moving it forward, and I appreciate the opportunity to testify. Thanks.
Thank you.
BG. Honorable Chair Dingfelder, committee. I've been in the sport fishing industry for 35 years. I represent Fisherman's Marine Supply.
Did you say your
Great
name?
Oregon.
Did you say your name, BG?
You did. Thanks, Jackie. No. BG Eilertson. And I am currently with Fisherman's Marine and Outdoors. Previously, I was with G.I. Joe's for a number of years. And I did provide written testimony, so I'm just going to be very brief. The sport fishing opportunity, especially in April and September in the Columbia River, is a lifeblood to our company and the 160 employees that we provide full-time jobs and benefits to. If we don't have the opportunity to fish in the peak of the April or September salmon runs in the Columbia River, we lose up to $60,000 a day. Okay. When I was at G.I. Joe's, the far-reaching effects
of the Columbia River spring Chinook fishery reached our stores in Issaquah, Washington, and the upriver stores in Kennewick, Washington. We're really missing the boat by not optimizing our sport fishing opportunity, the tourism that's involved with it. And so I ask you to support Senate Bill 830, because this is the best way to manage the Columbia River in this day and age. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Bob, why don't you go next?
Thank you, Chair Dingfelder, committee members. Bob Olson with the Association of Northwest Steelheaders. We want to thank you for this hearing and to acknowledge the strong commitment the governor has made to Columbia River fishing reform. Already you've heard about how this bill and the two important funds in it will implement a carefully developed program, providing more salmon to all fishing sectors. Very fair treatment is being accorded to the small group of commercial fishermen operating the Columbia River. In short, this bill represents an important advancement in fisheries management. Thank you for your consideration.
Thank you. Mr. Wolf.
Chair Dingfelder's committee members, for the record, my name is Tom Wolf, Chair of the Oregon Council of Trout Unlimited. Trout Unlimited, as a conservation group, has been working on these issues for a long time, concerned not so much about who got what part of the allocation pie, but about how we truly protect wild fish. We were going to be neutral on Measure 81 because we were concerned that it didn't deal with all the conservation issues that we wanted. We were pleased when the governor announced that he was going to take this issue on and move it to the ODFW Commission, which is where we felt it should have been from the get-go. And we are also pleased when they first started having their committee meetings that Trout Unlimited was invited to speak for the conservation voice, and we presented some issues that we thought should be included in the final plan, which included a barbless required for all recreational fishermen that fish on the Columbia River, looking at closing down the harvest of white sturgeon on the Columbia River if it continues to drop like it is, moving hatchery fish from the tributaries down to the safe areas and lessening the impact of hatchery fish there, and some other issues. And we were pleased to see that most of those issues were contained in the final plan, and therefore we supported that plan. So we also support House Bill 830, believing that it's kind of a promise that was made when this bill was passed that we would go forward and look at these funds that would provide for the issues elaborated both in the plan and in this bill. So we thank the governor for his leadership. We thank the ODFW Commission for what they've done, and we urge you to pass Senate Bill 830. Thank you.
Thank you, gentlemen. Any questions? All right, you're going to get off easy. Thank you. And we have the last people signed up is Bruce Buckmaster and Carrie Johnson from Clatsop County. Thank you for coming here today. And then is there anybody else who would like to testify, by the way, who is not signed up? So, Thane, why don't you come on up? And there's a gentleman back there, so you'll be up after that. Actually, there's a chair up here if you want to make your way up here. Thank you, gentlemen, whoever wants to go first.
Good afternoon, Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee. My name is Kerry Johnson, and I'm a fourth-generation commercial fisherman, and I'm the Oregon Legislative Co-Chair for Salmon for All. We are the organization that represents seafood consumers, fish buyers, processors, commercial fishermen, and other associated businesses. Our members provide millions of dollars of economic value to the state of Oregon, especially in our rural areas and lower river communities. Salmon are iconic to the Northwest, and if you look in the rotunda of this Capitol building, you'll see a commercial fisherman there with his nets and holding a salmon. Fishermen helped build this state, and commercial fishermen have a long history of being vocal advocates for salmon. Our livelihoods depend on their success. We work in the oldest continuing industry in the Pacific Northwest, and we are very proud of that heritage. One of the first things that Senate Bill 830 seeks to do in Section 1 is repeal a ban on a type of fishing net that was made illegal by initiative petition back in the late 40s. Now, that was a very long time ago. But another ballot measure, Measure 81, by initiative petition, was put to a direct vote just last November. It would have done the exact same thing that Senate Bill 830 proposes to do, which is legalize the use of seine nets. Every major newspaper in the state opposed Measure 81. It was put to a vote of the people, and over 1 million voters said no. It was a landslide vote, and that's a 2-to-1 margin. Oregonians value their fish and their fishermen. This bill would destroy commercial fishermen and does nothing to protect fish. In fact, the only thing it will do is make sure that the fish that are being caught now by commercial fishermen and delivered to the public for consumption would then be caught by a recreational fisherman. This has everything to do with allocation and nothing to do with conservation. Never once have commercial fishermen advocated for the removal of recreational fishermen from the river. We agree with the Oregon Constitution that requires equitable sharing of this public resource. We all should be working together to make sure that there are abundant fish for everyone to harvest and to enjoy. A very small percentage of Oregonians are actually sport fishermen, and it's a fraction of those who belong to the special interest groups pushing for these things that would wipe out our businesses and deny Oregonians' ability to taste of the Columbia River's bounty. Those of you sitting on this committee are elected, and you know that votes matter. Our system of government depends on you to uphold this process. Oregonians especially value the initiative process as a form of direct democracy. And for the legislature to do what Oregonians have just voted not to do would be wrong. Here are some of the reasons why ballot measure 81 and Senate Bill 830 are bad ideas. And I have a unique perspective on this, on what this bill would do, because I've seen and done it firsthand. For the last 2 years, my family has contracted with both the states of Oregon and states of Washington Fish and Wildlife Departments, testing the use of alternative gear and specifically the use of seine nets on the Columbia River. So I have experience with both types of fishing gear. I can tell you that those who support the use of seine nets as an alternative to gill nets have no understanding of how this commercial fishing gear actually works. Seine nets are designed to catch massive volumes of fish when fish are at the peak of their run timing. The mesh size of seine netting is very small and does not allow smaller fish to pass through like a gill net would. Any type of fish a seine net encounters are captured and must be hand sorted. When catching large volumes of fish that need to be sorted and some of them are released, some of them are going to die, just like some fish released by recreational fishing gear caught by hook and line are going to die. No type of fishing gear is entirely selective, including hook and line. But having worked with both types of fishing gear, I'm convinced that a gill net is a more selective and versatile tool than a seine net is. A seine net, in order to be effective, must be used during the peak of the run timing. This is the same time that recreational fishermen need to be on the river in order for their user group to be effective. And so a massive conflict is now created. Studies have not been completed to assess the mortality rates of this type of fishing gear, nor has NOAA Fisheries approved them for use on the Columbia River. To even be suggesting a repeal on the ban of seine nets to replace gill nets is incredibly premature and certainly not justified as an emergency. Other major components of Senate Bill 830 create compensation programs for economic losses resulting from restrictions, financial assistance for those who have economic harm due to loss of fishing opportunities, and establishing county programs for compensation. Of course, all of this is subject to available funding. Now, at a time when all state agencies are trying to figure out how or where funding is going to come from, this bill implements a plan that will suck millions of much-needed dollars away from schools, public safety, and other necessary functions of government. The commercial fishermen who this is supposedly going to help do not want this welfare program that this funding seeks to provide. In no way can the legislature provide the long-term funding stability that we need as small businesses for this program to move forward. Oregonians don't want it. It doesn't help salmon. It can't be funded, it shouldn't be funded, and it goes against the will of the people and should not be supported. We urge you to reject this bill and not pass it out of this committee.
Thank you. Mr. Buckmaster, if you can pull the microphone over, thank you.
Chair Dingfelder, Senators, my name is Bruce Buckmaster. I'm the retired CEO of BioOregon in Warrenton and a community advocate from Astoria. I served as an advisor to the bi-state commission work group for the Governor Kitzhaber's plan. Anybody who would suggest that the lower Columbia community in any way is supportive of this plan should be disabused of that notion. It is unanimous in opposition. It has been said that there is no conservation benefit. The impacts that are currently being used by the commercial fishery will be rolled over to the sport fishery, and those listed fish will be killed. We've addressed this Safe for Salmon. It was said earlier that Safe for Salmon is the progenitor of this particular plan, and it is. And that plan did not get any foothold at the legislature for a number of very good reasons. When we look at 90,000 endorsements for this $9.50 additional charge, we've got to remember that 90,000 Oregonians is approximately, it's 2.3% of the population. You should know that the cost of operating the Columbia River hatcheries, when we look at that, about 7% of the cost of operating comes from, and that's generous, comes from sport fishing monies. That includes Wallop Brew money. And the rest of it is coming from all Oregonians. The public fishermen, the commercial fishermen of the Lower Columbia, are the providers. These are hardworking small businesses that will be likely wiped out. Now, there's a sense that these guys, these fishermen, just don't want to change, but the facts disprove that. They developed the tangle net so they could prosecute the spring salmon fishery, which has been successful. They are testing seines to see if they work. The idea that seines are currently legal in Washington or Oregon is incorrect. Washington can make them legal, but they do have to be approved by the federal government. And testing is being done. If that is in place, we're concerned that the seines, as currently outlined, might include or provide jobs for a small fraction of the current Lower Columbia commercial fishermen, and we don't think that is fair. We believe the governor when he says he wants a win-win, but if we believed it was a win-win, we wouldn't be here in opposition. All of the uncertainties of this plan rest fully on the shoulders of the Lower Columbia. Senate Bill 830 is enabling legislation to move the governor's plan forward. We think the governor's plan needs more time, more work. We need to have funding. The major funding for the select areas now comes from Bonneville Power, from the Northwest Power Planning. They have sent a letter to Clatsop County and to say that that funding will cease. The monies in the governor's budget do not even appropriately backfill what will be lost. So that the idea that somehow we have enough money to make this plan work is simply not true. Can it work? We don't know yet. We need time. And passing Senate Bill 830 will keep that train on the tracks and make it impossible for us to work collaboratively with the commissions, with the department, and with those many sports fishermen who don't want to see the demise of our community. And for that, we would ask you to vote no on 830 and allow the process at the commission level to continue on. The bill, an appropriate bill, may come back to you when it's time. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Thane, I'm going to ask you to really be brief because we have a lot of people that challenge. Have to fly behind you.
Thane
I know
Jensen,
it is because you're an attorney.
Chair Dingfelder, Paul Center. I'm Thane Jensen, 2067 Northwest Irving, Portland, Oregon. But I grew up, was born and raised in Astoria, as were my parents before me. My grandfather was a gillnet fisherman from Astoria, Oregon. I grew up in the fishery, participated in it, both in the Columbian and Bristol Bay. The Bristol Bay fishery, as you may know, is the largest salmon fishery in the world. It's the most successful fishery, and it's a gillnet fishery. And there's a reason that it is a gillnet fishery, as the gillnet fishery exists not only in Alaska, Canada, Puget Sound, but on the Columbia. And that's because, what you've heard, it is a selective fishery. It isn't a curtain of death. It's a very easily managed fishery. It's a pretty successfully managed fishery. ODF&W will tell you that because you can, first of all, every fish is accounted for. It's regulated by time and season. I mean, fishery is only prosecuted on certain hours of certain days during certain times of the year with minimum fish sizes and minimum mesh sizes, maximum mesh sizes. And as a consequence, these nets can go in and out on a half an hour's notice. I mean, that's what makes this fishery such an easily managed one. It is a key component of all of the fishery management plans that have been adopted for the Columbia River for the last, you know, how many decades. I started working, the reason I'm here today, I'm here as a citizen. Nobody's paying me. I'm not, got a checkbook here. I'm here because I care about the fishery, and it's dismaying to me to see, as somebody who has spent a good deal of the last 30 years advocating for salmon recovery, to see this yet another round of fish fights between sport and commercial fisheries. A lot of the sport fishermen that I've worked with over the last 30 years have recognized the futility of that effort and have worked together. And I like to think, and I think fairly, that one of the reasons that we're rebuilding these runs successfully and have made such strides over the last 30 years in getting these fish runs back to where they were historically
is
because we've all worked together. This bill takes away that important voice of the gillnetters. And there's no legitimate scientific or conservation purpose for it. I urge you to, I think Bruce's suggestion, you don't make fish policy in the legislature. That's what we have a commission for. Let the process play itself out and let them make a decision based on biology and science, not on politics. Thank you.
Thank you.
I'll try to be really quick.
And to make sure you say your name
for the record. Chair Dingfelder, my name is Steve Fick. I'm representing West Coast Seafood Processors Association today. That's made up of processors along the Oregon, Washington, California coasts. There's no guaranteed funding down the road for this proposal. And when you look at this, the work that the department has done on this, we now meet essentially all of the objectives of the recreational fishery on the Columbia River. We have a spring fishing opportunity. We have a August fishery, September somewhere. They're fishing somewhere on the Columbia River. Buoy 10 goes till the end of the year. And my point there is when you model out taking the commercial fishery off the river, for $6 million, the cost of some of the proposals within the governor's plan, for $6 million, you will maybe get one more day of spring salmon fishing if it doesn't run into catch balancing with the tribal agreements we have. The social equity thing, my 30 jobs in Oregon on the coast are really important to those 30 people. They are with benefits. We hire a lot of college kids in the summertime. We create a lot of opportunity, lifelong opportunities, by good-paying jobs that can pay their college tuition through these salmon opportunities in the summer. And I don't see, if I felt we were going to get the same amount of fish by catching them in another manner, I certainly would be in support of it. But as we've talked about so far, the studies aren't done. The process isn't to see even if they're as selective as the gillnet fishery right now. So there's a lot of questions here. It should go back to the commission. And as I've done 20 years ago, I worked with a lot of the advocates here today that are now currently trying to put me out of business. So I would promote a no on 8:30.
Thank you. Gentlemen, I'll see if there's any questions for any of these gentlemen.
Anyone can answer this. Does the four-year transition period provide any relief or lack of angst? I mean, it looks like they were wanting to phase that in.
Chair Dingfelder, Senator Hansel, I compare it to knowing the day of my death and knowing whether it's going to happen right now or in a couple years. It doesn't make me feel a whole lot better. The result is the same thing. The effect of Measure 81 was immediate. The effect of this pushes it out a couple years, but I know the end result, so it doesn't help. No.
Yeah. If I may add to that, a lot of the fishing proposals that they're suggesting through seine fishing, there is not the area in the river to participate in those fisheries. And what's really basically going to happen is if you go along for 4 years, you'll essentially see no transition, and then all of a sudden there'll be a huge transition where a lot of people will be put out of work and a lot of lack of opportunity.
to harvest with a seine in these areas where these fish need to be harvested.
Thank you. Any other questions? All right, thank you very much, gentlemen. Appreciate your testimony today. Okay, that's the last that we have signed up for the public hearing. Going once, going twice. Anybody else testify on Senate Bill 830? Okay, seeing none, we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 830. I'm just going to make an announcement that we will do the hearing on 840 last, because we have a lot of people here to testify in 835, and I have a senator that wants to testify as well. So we'll go ahead and open up the public hearing on Senate Bill 835. Senator Hass and Senator Hansel, your fingerprints both are on this bill. Do you want to say a few words? And then, Senator Whitsitt, why don't you come up, and we'll have you after they do the introduction. And Beth? Oh, yes, and Rep. Gomberg, too, somewhere here. Beth, can you read the bill introduction? I'm going to have the folks at the dais, the sponsors, and then we'll have Senator Whitsitt and Rep. Gomberg. Thank you for your patience.
Madam Chair and committee members, for the record, there's a no revenue impact and minimal fiscal impact statement issued on the bill. It states that Senate Bill 835 states that conducting or participation in rodeos is permitted in the state of Oregon. It prohibits treating rodeos less favorably than other organized exhibitions or events, and establishes that a person commits the offense of equine tripping if a person intentionally causes an equine to trip or fall, intentionally ropes or lassos the leg of an equine for the purposes of rodeo, contest, exhibition, entertainment, or sports, or as a practice for events.
Okay, thank you. Gentlemen?
Thank you, Chair Dinkfelter. This feels like we've
deja
just
vu.
Done this.
Yes.
So I won't repeat my testimony about horse tripping. I think my position is pretty clear. I think it's a very, very cruel practice and should be outlawed in Oregon, just as it has been in 12 other states. And so I will be brief. I know we have some cowboys here, and I'm anxious to hear from them. But we have a lot of cowboys who share this sentiment, particularly the Professional Rodeo Cowboys Association, which has long banned this process. And I agree with them on this. I agree with the Pendleton Roundup, the Malala Rodeo, the St. Paul Rodeo, and all of the major rodeos in this country and in this state, which has banned this process. These horses, and I say this as a horse owner, typically weigh more than 1,000 pounds. And unlike steers or calves, they have a center of gravity that is several feet higher in the air. The sheer physics of these half-ton creatures crashing into the ground from that distance is why they are often hurt. And so when we did this bill earlier, we had a lot of testimony to this point. And my good colleague came forward and said, you know, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but I think you shared my sentiments on horse tripping, but said one thing we could do is incorporate a rodeo bill of rights that would ensure that there's no perception that this bill is intended to make inroads at rodeos. And as a longtime rodeo fan, I was happy to do that. We could not amend that language into the other bill because the technical relating clause was too narrow. So we started all over. And we have these two sets of language into a much more broader relating clause. And I think this bill is overdue. I think it is bipartisan. And I very definitely want Oregon to join those other states that have already outlawed this practice.
Senator Hansel, did you want to say a few words?
If I may, Senator Hass has certainly captured this well. And as far as the history, it appeared to me that the bill, as originally heard and is still a viable bill, was based upon the people that signed off on it, and the interaction was going to pass. Senator Hass made it very clear that this was not an anti-rodeo bill. Talking with my good friend from Pendleton, Doug Corey mentioned that the state of Missouri was working on a bill to secure the right to rodeo there, and we looked at that, and the senator was willing, as was the chair, to have a blended bill, and with that we have before us today. So I wanted to incorporate in state statute the right to rodeo, similar to what we've done to the right to farm. And that was my motivation to move the two bills into one section.
Great. Thank you. Senator Whitsitt, thank you for your patience.
Thank you, Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Senator Doug Whitsitt, representing all or
most of five rural Southern Oregon counties. My concerns regarding Senate Bill 865 are limited to Section 2. As you may know, I practice veterinary medicine in a rural practice with five veterinarians for about 30 years. I'm a past president of the Oregon Veterinary Medical Association, of the Klamath County Cattlemen's Association, and a variety of different horse clubs and associations over the years. Representative Whitson and I have also bred, trained, and marketed sport horses for more than 20 years. Horses are prey animals. When confronted with danger, they either freeze or fly away as fast as they can run. That's what they do. The average adult horse is also 7-8 times as big as an average man and infinitely stronger. The restraint of an unbroke, fractious horse out in the open basically includes three possibilities, Madam Chair. You can rope the horse around the neck, you can rope it around the legs, or you can use a projectile dart to tranquilize or immobilize the animal, and I've used all three frequently. Using a projectile is fraught with difficulty and danger. Using a curare-type drug causes the horse to go down almost immediately. Unfortunately, some of the horses never get up, ever. Using a tranquilizer like xylazine or dromosidan works well after it takes effect, but it takes 5 to 10 minutes. Unfortunately, when you shoot a wild horse in the backside, it runs away very rapidly. And in 5 or 10 minutes, it can cover half a mile, 2 miles, whatever, depending on how many fences it runs through and how many pieces of equipment it tears up. It continues to flee blindly until it loses control and flops down on the ground and finally goes down. Unfortunately, too, is the fact that it often runs through has caused itself so much damage that it's irreparable. When an unbroke horse is roped around the neck, it will struggle, and it will pull back until it chokes down. And if you're quick enough, you can get on its head and get a halter on it or tie its legs together, or it gets up, and then you get to choke it down again. And it will pull back until it actually loses consciousness and falls over. Those are the options. The third alternative is the one that I prefer, and that is roping a horse by a front leg or both front legs. Once you picked up a front leg, the horse is immobilized. It will pull back, and as soon as it realizes it can't get away, it freezes like a deer would freeze in the headlights. Sometimes it falls down more than once. But once it has understood that you have it by a front leg, that horse will stand there and let you approach, put a halter on it, and often do whatever you need to do with the horse. My point is that roping a horse by the front leg is a common and useful tool in equine husbandry, something we use every day of our lives. To regulate the practice simply demonstrates a lack of understanding on the part of those who would establish the regulation. And finally, changing just a single word in this proposed statute would effectively eliminate rodeo in Oregon. If you were to change in Section 2, Sub 2, the word equine and replace it with livestock, it would read, a person commits the offense of livestock tripping if the person intentionally causes the livestock to trip or fall for purpose of rodeo, contest, exhibition, entertainment, or sport, or as a practice for rodeo, contest, exhibition, entertainment, or sport. The offense of livestock tripping is a Class B misdemeanor. It would just take one word, Madam Chair, to make rodeo illegal in Oregon. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative. Thank you for your patience as well.
Oh, thank you very much, Madam Chair. I'm David Gomberg from House District 10 on the Oregon coast. My district ranges from Waldport to Tillamook. I've got a $500 million fishing industry on the coast. I'm happy to be patient and let other people testify on other issues here today. I'm here today because I testified on the previous version of this bill, and I think I made my comments pretty straightforward and clear to all of you, but we've got a new bill before us, and I thought it worthwhile to come in and say to you in very simple terms, rodeo good, horse tripping for entertainment purposes bad, and to indicate for your benefit that I believe that this is a statewide issue. I'm from the coast. The co-sponsors of this bill are from the Eastern Oregon and from the metropolitan area. I think it's also a bill that's got bipartisan and bicameral support. I appreciate the remarks of my friend from the Senate, but I would stress to you that the wording of this bill focuses on entertainment. horse tripping for entertainment purposes and doesn't talk about the other kinds of more legitimate reasons to immobilize an equine. And it speaks to specifically tripping for entertainment purposes or practicing for entertainment purposes and specifically excludes other kinds of things. The word that he was concerned about simply isn't in the legislation, so I don't think we have to be concerned about that today. This is not the tip of the iceberg. This is a piece of legislation aimed at the dangerous and unfortunate practice of intentionally tripping a galloping horse for entertainment purposes, and I'd be happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Thank you. Any questions for either of these representatives or senators? No. Senator Hess? No. Okay. Thank you very much for your testimony here. Okay, we have a number of people that came from over 100 miles away, so we're going to call them up first. Vern Kirshner, Todd Gulch, and Jerry Rayburn. Am I saying your name right? You're taking over. We'll be right back. Okay.
Gentlemen, welcome to the Capitol.
Thank you. Thank you. I'll wait till Senator Dingfelder come back.
Well, she just said that. You can go ahead and proceed.
Chair people, Senator Dingfelder, my name is Vernon Kirshner, and I'm president of the Jordan Valley Rodeo Board. The concerns that I have in opposition to Senate Bill 835 and Bill 790 against horse roping. I call it horse roping, not horse tipping. Horse tipping is a buzzword, trying to make people think that's all we're trying to do is trip the horse. A team roping a horse to catch the horse around the neck to get control of the horse. Then the front footer catches the horse around the feet. If you have to catch a horse to brand and castrate them, then you catch them this way. And then you lay them down to work on the horse. In the rodeo, all that is required is to catch the horse by the neck, then catch his front feet, then the flag is dropped. The horse is released. They are not laid down or tripped, as the general public is led to believe. This is how untamed horses are worked in real life. It is a tradition and culture that has been around since man began using horses to make America what it is today, and is still done this way on ranches today. The Jordan Valley Rodeo has very good rules in force on how to handle a horse and not harm him. We have a professional flaggers that can and will flag ropers out if they don't handle the horse right. The little towns in eastern Oregon don't have a whole lot going for them. One of the biggest incomes is from this rodeo for Jordan Valley. A lot of the hard work, long hours, is what we have to look forward to, and helping the local business and community groups with some of their annual income. Jordan Valley Rodeo is one of the first rodeos in the spring. After a hard winter of feeding cattle, calving cows, we look forward to the Big Loop Rodeo. We get several thousand people from Oregon, Nevada, Idaho, and people from all around the world come to watch this horse roping. The city park is full of all kinds of Western trade gear that you can think of, and it's all Western. The video and pictures the Humane Society of the United States put out on the horse roping shows that a horse might go down, which sometimes they do, but we're not intentionally trying to trip them. And that's what we got to get through to everybody, that it's not a horse tripping, it's a horse roping. They got videos of horses going down, which, like I said, some of them do. But that's where the picture stops. They don't show that horse getting up, his tail in the air and his head up high, trotting to the other horses. just laughing that you didn't get me. And this is very misleading to the public. If this bill is passed, it would not only affect the rodeo, but the whole community of Jordan Valley. And in any small community that has horse roping, it'll just kill them. Like our rodeo, it's a unique big loop rodeo. It's a 20-foot loop. There's already laws in the state of Oregon that on animal abuse. Why have another law on the books? We ask that you vote no on this bill, Senate Bill 835 and Senate Bill 790. And I thank you.
Thank you. Sir?
Madam Chair Dingfelder and chair members, I'm Todd Glue, and I'm a Jordan Valley Rodeo Board member. And I have a letter here from the Malheur County Sheriff, Brian Wolf, and since you have it, I'll just highlight points that, you know, he couldn't make it today, so.
Thank you. Do we have Malheur? Oh, it's on the
computer. Malheur County, okay. You got it?
Yeah, it's on our computer, so it's in a file. Pull it right up. Thank you.
Malheur County is the second largest county in Oregon, covering almost 10,000 square miles. It's sparsely populated with 32,000 people and 248,000 cattle and approximately 6,000 head of horses. Malheur County enjoys a rich heritage with the livestock industry. Jordan Valley is located in the southern Malheur County. Jordan Valley is supported by the livestock industry, and most of the ranches in Jordan Valley are multi-generational ranches. Jordan Valley is also known for the Big Loop Rodeo, which is 54 years strong. One of the events included in the rodeo is the Big Loop Rodeo is horse roping. There's much controversy in reference to the roping of the horses at the rodeo. And I believe the controversy comes from a lack of understanding and education of those who are opposing it. I personally have been contacted by animal rights people who believe the practice of the horse roping should be prohibited. Some of these people have referred me to YouTube videos of the injured animals from horse roping. I later learned that the video that I was watching wasn't from horses that was roped at all. Some of the people also referred to the horse roping as horse tripping. The object of the horse is to rope it and not trip it. You lay the horse down like to brand them or castrate them on the ranch, but I mean, when the horse is caught and the ropes come tight, then the horse is released. The participants have the understanding that if they are too rough on the animal, they will be disqualified from the event. I can tell you that the people in the Jordan Valley area and the rodeo are responsible for the events that they carry and they are concerned about the welfare of the animals. We all know that similar to well-conditioned athletes, the injuries will happen. Anytime an animal is injured, they are professionally cared for by a licensed veterinarian. The Malheur County Sheriff's Office has and will continue to monitor the event of the horse roping. And to this point, we do not believe the animals being used in this event are being mistreated. And I personally oppose any and all legislation, laws, and or rules prohibiting rodeo, including the horse roping. Respectfully, Brian Wolf.
Thank you. Well, my computer doesn't want to cooperate today, so I'm going to shut it. Thank you for your testimony, sir.
Chocolate, then?
I guess I'm going to have to for everybody. It was my computer, not my phone, but okay. It's doing something strange.
Well, my name is Jerry Rayburn. I'm from Jordan Valley. And thank you for hearing this. And I'm asking you to oppose the so-called horse tripping bill. And I'm addressing this issue from my association with the Jordan Valley Big Loop Rodeo and none others, because I have not witnessed any of the other rodeos. So, first of all, what we do is not horse tripping. It is horse roping with a 20-foot loop. It takes extremely skilled ropers to make a qualifying run with that size loop. And of the 90 teams that we will have every year, we will probably have less than 10 actually make a qualified run because of the skill involved. And any roughness of the stock causes immediate disqualification. So, and I understand that most of your motion is based on the video taken last year at a rodeo. I've seen it, and I can understand how it would affect you, but First of all, that horse was not a roped horse. It was a rough stock saddle bronc horse. And it was such an unusual accident that caused us totally by surprise. And no one could understand why it happened. We still don't know. The video has been used for shock value, and it is edited to put us in the worst possible light. And in spite of what you heard, there were no other stock injuries. And our arena's worked up, the ground is soft, so if a horse does fall down, it's a soft landing. And remember, this is the same ground the Cowboys are landing on. So another thing I'd like for you to consider is that we've been doing the Big Loop event for 50 years, and we've had tens of thousands of people witness that from all walks of life, all countries, the United States, and we have not had any complaints like we've had from this video that's been edited. So, and I guess I would really like for you to witness our event before you make judgment on it, but I want to insert a little something into this that we not, it's not in my testimony, but we started this Rodeo Wonder, this association, in 1959 to celebrate the Oregon Centennial of the Oregon Statehood. It's been going ever since, and we did write a book talking about the history of the Jordan Valley Rodeo, how the Big Loop got started. I'd be more than glad to share with anybody. I'd send you a book to read about it so you can understand we've been doing this a long time. And we did start the Big Loop in 1962. We had about three rodeos without it, but it's been going on since 1962. So my other appeal is from the economic side of this issue. In 1961, the Rodeo Board wanted to have an event that would make the rodeo unique. Thus, the Big Loop was introduced as an event. And the history of it would be in this book, and we're not going to go into that today. So appreciate that. So.
Okay, can I ask you to wrap up, as we do have many other people who'd like to testify.
Okay, so I'll go to this. I'm afraid if this Big Loop event is eliminated, we'd just become just another rodeo, just like anybody else, and that would be very damaging to our economy. And as Oregon State Senators, I would hope that you'd also be concerned about the economic issues of small towns like Jordan Valley. Not only is the rodeo a boost for the businesses there, the volunteer groups, and I know Jake's going to talk about that, so I, in the interest of time, I will go on. And our trade show is a Western must-see event that benefits several of our local artists, as well as many from other parts of the West. Another economic thing to consider, since the Big Loop horses are raised and rented from the Death Valley Indian Reservation, it all affects many Paiute Shoshone people who supply the horses for the event. And also, does it make any sense that somebody would supply horses if those horses were going to be injured? Think about that, people. And so we as the Jordan Valley Rodeo Board do not receive any compensation. It's quite the opposite. We do it for our community. We take pride in what we've accomplished over the years. We think it is only fair to ask that you at least witness our event in person before you pass judgment. Thank you very much for hearing us.
Thank you, gentlemen, for coming here today. Let's see if there's any questions for any of these gentlemen.
I guess I just have one thing. I mean, I first of all, really appreciate you guys coming over here. I know it's kind of a long haul. And whatever we call it, whether it's horse roping or horse tripping, why do you think the professional cowboys have banned this? Why do you think the big rodeos don't want to do this? Why do you think the state of Texas has outlawed this?
I think...
Sir, can you state your name again for the record, please?
Vernon Kirshner.
And we need a microphone so we can all hear you. Thank you.
Vernon Kirshner. I think what they were doing is making rules on horse tripping at the Mexican rodeos. That's where they was catching the horses by the front feet and tipping them over. And they're not catching them by the head. I talked to the president of the Carlo Rodeo Association that catches those horses like that. They have abandoned that at their sanctioned rodeos since 1995, and they do not trip any horses in that style. And I think there's some gentlemen here who are telling you the very
same thing. They're signed up to testify, so we'll hear from them.
Okay.
But one thing we want to emphasize, we're not out there to be tripping horses. And I don't think people on this side of the state understand that. Thank you.
Thank you, gentlemen, for coming.
By the front feet in the cattle. Stomp by the head, the header, and they're not being tripped.
Thank you for your testimony. We have some other folks who would like to testify. We have the mayor of Jordan Valley, Mr. Jake Rowe, Wani McKenzie, I'm sorry, I'm hoping I'm getting these right, and Bob Skinner, and Toby De La Torre from Toros Federation. There's four chairs up here, so come on up. Thank you, gentlemen. Whoever wants to go first.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I am Mayor Jake Rowe from Jordan Valley, Oregon. I've been the mayor there for the last 15 years, and currently I serve as the vice chairman of the Jordan Valley School District, and I'm a member of the Volunteer Fire Department and a small business owner. And I ask that you oppose Senate Bill 835 and Senate Bill 790. It is a causeless bill that would have devastating effects on our economy and our community. The Big Loop event is unique, and it brings 5,000 to 6,000 people to our remote community every year. Not having this event at the rodeo would negatively affect the attendance and result in a drastic loss in revenue, like closing down the rodeo altogether. The economy of Jordan Valley is based on ranching, mining, and a handful of small businesses. The Big Loop Rodeo brings money in from outside of our community, which keeps the local economy healthy. A variety of organizations and businesses in the area benefit from the money brought in by the rodeo. The Volunteer Fire Department rents out the city park to over 100 vendors that come from all over the United States and from other countries to sell high-quality handmade goods that we use during ranching life and art that you just won't find in stores. This fundraiser nets almost $10,000 annually, and it's 100% of the fundraising for the Volunteer Fire Department. In addition, the Booster Club for the school, they hold a dinner that raises about $5,000. Money for that is spent on athletic and academic programs in the school. The local Lions Club, they host a dance at the gym during this rodeo event, and that brings in money that helps them to keep the lights on in a community center that we use as a meeting place during the year. The Catholic Church, along with that, cooks breakfast on Sunday morning. And that brings in about $1,000 for the community, for the Catholic Church. They use that kind of money to keep their parish hall open. The local service agencies profit as well. The Jordan Valley EMTs, a volunteer staff unit that covers 7,000 square miles. I'm sure around here your EMT services cover very small areas. Where we live, they have to cover a lot of ground, and it costs a lot of money to respond to calls sometimes when people aren't there and there's nobody to bill. Those funds are used to cover those kinds of costs to make sure that they can keep their wheels turning on their ambulance. The Sheriff's Posse also sells food at the park to raise money. The money that they make for the Sheriff's Posse helps them with search and rescue to find lost motorists. We have a lot of area out there where cell phones don't work. Those particular areas where the cell phones don't work and stuff, you have to spend a lot of time sometimes looking for people. Young people in our community also benefit. The 4-H kids sell programs. The FFA students and the other school groups earn about $12,000 throughout this weekend rodeo, and they use that to spend money on field trips. Right now, they've taken a field trip from Jordan Valley all the way over to this side of the state for a biology trip. They use it for Fun Not Fatal after graduation. They use the money to actually pay for their graduation, to do the decorations and stuff at the school, and it's very important for their school experience. Finally, in our town, the local restaurants, the RV parks, the motels, the gas stations, they all benefit greatly from the busiest weekend of the year. Malheur County is one of the poorest counties in the state of Oregon. Jordan Valley is in the most remote part of that county with very few opportunities to bring in extra dollars. The rodeo provides critical economic resource along with the event that celebrates our way of life. This kind of pointless legislation has far-reaching unintentional consequences that will hurt our community and our county. I'm a mechanic by profession, and what I know is how to fix things. As you representatives of the public also have the ability to fix things, you can oppose this causeless bill full of unintended consequences and help maintain the economic health of an entire community. And please vote no on Senate Bill 835 and 790.
Thank you, Mayor, for your testimony, and we appreciate you coming over here today.
Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Wani McKenzie. I'm a 38-year-old member of the Jordan Valley Rodeo Board. I would like to talk to you about the rules that we have in place for the horse roping and explain why I oppose Senate Bill 835. We have many rules and regulations in place to protect the welfare of all the animals we use in the rodeo. We have three field judges in the arena at all times. I am one of them. And a barrier which gives the animal a head start. If you break the barrier, you're given a 15-second penalty. Whereas in other rodeo events, the penalties are only 5 to 10 seconds. No rubber on your horn is not allowed, again, to keep the animal from harm. You must catch the animal around the neck and two front feet. In any other catch, you are disqualified. When the ropers come tight, the time is stopped. Stock must be standing up when roped, and when it comes tight, stock must not be handled roughly at any time, and ropers will be disqualified if the opinion of the field judges have intentionally done so. Any stock injured will require immediately disqualification. The rules are designed to protect the animal at all times. Our rules are designed to protect the animal at all times. You need to understand that. We run the horses through before the rodeo starts to show them where the gates are. The majority of the ropers have enough stockman skills to handle the animals in a way that will not cause harms. Over the years, there has been a minimum time that the field judges have had to step in. As the runs occur, the field judges are in the arena advising and help to protect the animal. At the rodeo, we have a veterinary on the ground at all times. We feel that the cowboys that come to the Jordan Valley Rodeo are some of the best stockmen, horsemen in the rodeo ranching community. Most of the people that compete are employees or ranchers themselves, and many have attended beef quality assurance seminars and or other livestock handling seminars. For example, I've attended several horse handling seminars as well as two Temple Grandin seminars on livestock handling. Temple Grandin is a world-renowned consultant in livestock industry on animal behavior and promotes how to handle livestock in a safe and humane way. She has published several books, movies on the subject. Also, our ranch we are GAP 4 certified. This is a global animal practice rating which only is given out to ranches that qualify. I would like to invite you to come to our rodeo and also come visit us on our ranch and see how hard we work at being good stewards of the livestock, wildlife, and our land. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your testimony.
Can I ask you, do you have any questions?
We're going to take all the testimony and we'll see if there's any questions.
Okay.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Jingfelder and the committee members. I'm going to tell you ahead of time that I've scratched out a whole lot of my testimony to try to speed
you
up.
Thank you.
So I hope I can keep straight as I wade through this with black marks all over. My name is Bob Skinner. I'm a fifth generation from as far away from Salem as you can get and still call Oregon home. It takes us one day to get here, one day to be here, and one day to get home when we don't have the time to spare. You're a long ways away. We live in a small remote community located in what we call the forgotten corner of Oregon. Prior to internet, it was impossible to know how Oregon election returns turned out for days after the polls closed. The maps of Oregon, and I serve on a lot of committees for the state of Oregon, do a lot of traveling. The maps of Oregon nearly always have the legend covering the area we live in. It's really easy, folks, for us to feel like the rest of the state doesn't really care about us much and doesn't put any value in where we live. I'm here today to speak against Senate Bill 835 and 790. I feel that the very name of the bill horse tripping is deliberately designed to be misleading. This is not horse tripping. I've seen videos. I've seen several videos that have been produced that absolutely, positively, grossly misrepresent the real event. And it's always amazing to me, as I've been filmed as much as anybody, how editing affects the end result. And I'd like to ask anyone here, or maybe suggest that maybe you haven't really seen the real event. If you haven't seen the real event, don't pass judgment on what you saw on the videos. It doesn't look like the videos. And I'd be happy to elaborate on that later, but I won't now. As past president of the Oregon Cattlemen's Association, I've had the opportunity to travel across Oregon corner to corner and been back and forth. One of the biggest challenges this state has is the urban-rural divide. And that's in Oregon, it can be called the east-west divide. A lot of the issues is cultivated by extremists that not only don't understand, but worse than that, spend countless hours and resources trying to change our way of life and our livelihood. If there's legislation passed out of this building that further drives a wedge between East and West Oregon, such as 835 and 790 would do, I can see nothing but more contempt, distrust, and genuine feeling of alienation from the rural areas of this state. This absolutely moves this state in the wrong direction. As state and local governments keep telling us that we need to be one unified Oregon for the benefit of all, these two bills would definitely prove beyond a reason of a doubt to rural Oregon, and especially eastern Oregon, that the metro area has no intention of understanding and working with us. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Mr. De La Torre, did I get that right? My Spanish is pretty rusty, but yes. I'm my best.
Thank you. It is, yeah. Chair and Senators Hansel and Haas. My name is Toby De La Torre. I represent approximately 3,500 registered members of the Charro organizations. And it's all of this testimony is very, very interesting to me, and I'm glad that I have this opportunity to be able to share. First of all, one of the things that Senator Haas mentioned was that the act of horse tripping was banned in 13 states. And that is why this concerns me so much. The state of Maine and the state of Florida have never seen a charro in their life. Horse tripping didn't exist in those two states. They didn't even have testimony. They didn't have nothing. They had animal activists that were trying to pass laws to do exactly what they're good at doing, passing a bunch of laws. So as far as 13 states, two of them didn't have it. The other five, I wasn't around, and a lot of us weren't concerned to defend something that we no longer did, because as soon as it was passed in California in 1995, for the sake of sportsmanship, for the sake of public relations, we voluntarily banned it from our events. I was very busy. I didn't know. I even left my luggage at the airport. I was in such a hurry because I've been working on the bill in Nevada. That got dropped. They had to pull it off because the wording was ambiguous and it was going to affect cattlemen and everybody else. So they dropped it right now, and they're trying to work with us to have better wording so that it doesn't have the chain effect that they're looking for. Although you guys are against this bill, Senator Haas, what he might not be fully aware of is the Humane Society of the United States and the ASPCA are avidly against every rodeo event, including calf roping, steer wrestling. And they're just waiting for an act of roping an animal to be illegal, because then they're going to say, you can't rope a horse, you can't rope a cattle. They've done it over and over. They've attempted it. In Canada, they agreed that all they wanted to do was stop calf roping. They got it passed. 2 weeks later, they proposed to ban steer wrestling. It just doesn't work. They don't stick with, you know, their claims.
I still have about 10 people want to testify, okay. So I'm going to ask you to wrap up.
What I do want to let you know is that there is one video out there with a horse getting tripped in Nevada. Senator Ford stood up. Eric Mills stood up, which is an activist, and says, yes, that was one isolated accident. They have thousands and thousands and thousands of hours of video, but they show one accidental horse tripping. The wording in the bill of roping a horse's legs would knock out two of our events where we do not trip horses. I don't know if you're aware of the rules and our events, but just because of the wording of your law that has a concern about tripping, it would eliminate our events. You have approximately 400 registered charros in Oregon, and it's growing and growing. People from Idaho come to Oregon, from Washington, and there's a representative here from Oregon. He would know more. You get tourism from this, and no horses are tripped, but you would knock us out. And I'm just going to leave it at that, just so that everybody else can testify, but I'll be here. I won't leave till tomorrow if you guys have any questions. I have other videos and my laptop's at the airport in California, but showing our events, and there's no tripping going on. And as far as the Jordan Valley, you're looking at the worst case scenarios. There's things that they can do, but what the mayor said, the effects of this kind of thing, the damages, I think we should be more concerned about human rights and take more into consideration the long-term effects. Thank you
for your testimony. I'll see if there's any questions for any of the gentlemen. All right. Thank you very much. Thank you for your testimony, and thanks for coming all the way here today. We have several other people that would like to testify. Miguel Serrano, Ivan Orozco, Ishmael Huramio. Hopefully I'm saying that right. And Noe Orozco? Noe? Is there a Noe here?
No, he's not here.
No. And Denise Hernandez? Okay. Thank you, gentlemen. Whoever wants to go first? We just need a microphone, and if you can state your name, please.
My name is Miguel Serrano. I represent around 400 members, charros and escaramuzas, ladies teams, and charro teams here in the state of Oregon. Basically, this bill, Senate Bill 835, SB Senate Bill 790, eliminates our sport, our beautiful sport, is not from last year, from 100 years. Is from over 200 years, and we're inherit from our families, from grandpa, from fathers. It's a family sport that we are practicing here in the state of Oregon. As I mentioned, it's gonna hurt rodeo and charrería. It's gonna hurt economy because there's charros already visiting state of Oregon from state of Washington, state of Idaho, state of California, from other states. We go outside. This year we're gonna go participate in the national championship in Houston, Texas. We're gonna go to Las Vegas and to several states for the competitions. Basically, our efforts, please, senators, our efforts and our traditions, please keep those with us. We oppose to this bill, Senate Bill 835, Senate Bill 790. Please, senators, keep us our support here at State Oregon.
Thank you. Sir?
Good evening. Yeah. My name is Ivan Orozco.
You can move the mic, actually, if you like. Yeah, there you go.
Good evening. My name is Ivan Orozco. Thank you for giving us the opportunity to speak here. My family and I operate an indoor arena in the city of Cornelius for the last 2 years, and we board and host charreadas there. It's a very beautiful sport that has been growing very rapidly. In the 2 years that we've been there, I've seen a lot of, we have spent a lot of money in our community, and we try to keep our business in the community to help the communities and around communities grow. We have had hosts come from Idaho, Washington, and California, which spend and burn a bunch of gallons of fuel each time they come. My dad and I are very busy gathering cattle and feed for our animals, and we know that we spend a lot of money. A lot of our kids are joining the charros. We have a lot of charro kids from three-year-olds till very old adults. My mother, my sisters, my brother's wives, my wife, we all work together every time we have a charreada. It's growing very rapidly, and I can see that it's keeping our kids from being in front of TVs, seeing violent games, playing violent video games. And I oppose the Senate Bill 835. If you guys pass this bill, it would be like telling the Trailblazers to go and play at a horse arena with loose dirt. That's how bad it would harm our sport. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony.
Hi, my name is Ismael Jaramillo, and I'm the secretary of the Charro Association of the State of Oregon. I've been working really hard with Miguel and some other people trying to grow in charreria in the state. Like he was saying, like Ivan was saying, is a sport that is growing pretty rapidly. And we try to, you know, keep our young people occupied in a good sportsmanship. And it's a sport that comes or belongs to us from centuries. If you call it buckaroo, charro, cowboy, whatever you want to call it, we can have the same root. And we can have the same event, so we call it a little bit different, but it's based on the same stuff. So from California to Washington to Idaho, all the Northwest, we try to keep it organized and keep our community together. So really, we are opposed to this bill because it's a little ambiguous, and the word that is just tripping a horse, which is not really the matter to tripping the horse. You know, like I think that some other cowboys already mentioned that, so I'm not going to go over that because it will be overdone. But we just oppose that bill.
Thank you, Ms. Hernandez.
Good evening. I'm Denise Hernandez. I represent the women here in Oregon, in Charreria. And it's called Escaramuza. It's a sport to show the skills with the riders and the horses and a team. We want to keep the Charreria, to keep our traditions. And in our rules, it includes not risking the horses. So we want to maintain our traditions, the charreria.
Thank you. Any questions for any of these gentlemen or ladies? Thank you very much for coming here today. We certainly appreciate you sharing your testimony. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. David Aiken. David Aiken.
Madam Chair, Senators, my name is David Aiken, 7430 Southeast 35th Avenue, Portland, Oregon. I appeared before in regard to Senate Bill 790. I appeared in opposition. I'm also appearing in opposition to Senate Bill 835. The bill on its face seems perfectly innocuous, a well-meaning proposition to stop what appears to be an odious practice, tripping horses. To begin, the word tripping is a misnomer. It refers to the practice of Great Basin buckaroos and cowboys of roping horses by the head and the front feet. Roping the hind feet injures the horse and is never done by any working cowboy or buckaroo. Proponents of the bill show a horse falling on its muzzle. This is only one instance, not the norm. I've attended numerous ranch rodeos and have not seen this occurring. Almost always, horses' front leg roped fall on their sides if they fall at all. So why rope them? Many ranch horses, indeed most, are on the open range. They're not in stables. Mm-hmm. How to capture and doctor these horses? Here, horsey? I think not. For decades, Great Basin buckaroos and cowboys have been roping horses by the front legs as a necessity in part in their ranch work. It's a highly skilled activity performed in all of Oregon's high desert Great Basin counties. Because horse roping is a skilled activity, these hardworking eastern Oregonians get together in community ranch rodeos to test and perfect their horse roping skills. The rodeos are important activities in such places as Jordan Valley, and they've spoken to their rodeo, but also you need to consider that these are important activities in Paisley, Halfway, Burns, McDermott, and others. Try to attend one or more of these Eastern Oregon ranch rodeos if you can. You'll see for yourself the men and women who perform these activities as part of their ranch work. I'm amazed at the skill required and how few of the total horses are actually roped. Some have said the Professional Rodeo Cowboys Association, the PRCA, has outlawed so-called horse tripping. Outlawed. What does that mean? To whom does such outlawing apply? The claim is meaningless. It applies to the fact that horse roping is a competitive activity not performed at PRCA rodeos, an association wishing to dominate rodeo activity in the western United States. Ranch rodeos and horse roping are a very local activity of hardworking ranchmen and women. Yes, women, making a contest from their everyday ranch skills. Where are the women in PRCA rodeos? No place except barrel racing, and the barrel racing itself is not a PRCA activity. I'm sure the proponents of this bill are well-meaning people concerned with animal rights. I suggest that they are not fully or informed. Horses are a valuable tool in ranch work, and their welfare is of primary concern to all buckaroos and cowboys. None of these folks is interested in injuring their valuable animals. I've been fortunate since retiring to be able to work a sum of every month on an Eastern Oregon ranch and to actually work some ranch rodeos. This is a vital social community activity and is part of our state's eastern part, and I'd be happy to answer questions to the best of my abilities on all of my very positive experiences. Ladies and gentlemen, this bill is a humbug. Please do not vote for a bill which hurts our Eastern Oregon citizens.
Thank you for your testimony. Any questions? Okay. Thank you for coming back today.
Pleasure.
So we have three more people signed up. Cindy, I can't read your last name. I'm sorry. Barbara Call and Sarah Salen Eiler. Are you getting that right? Whoever wants to get started.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Senators. My name is Cindy Burko. I'm a horse lover and citizen from Dallas, Oregon. I've been a horse person now for nearly 60 years. I'm a rodeo fan and a former competitor. I used to compete in barrel racing and stock horse race. I used to be a dally roper. I was a heel roper for a long time till I finally figured out the cow wasn't having much fun. Then I gave it up. I've trained horses, I've bred horses, I've rescued and rehabbed, abused and neglected horses, and was a 4-H horse leader for 7 years. I know horses. It's my understanding that this horse roping, tripping, whatever you want to call it, event is patterned after the vaquero technique used to slow down a green horse or untrained horse to begin sensible schooling. It's important to remember that the participants of this event are not necessarily horse trainers or vaqueros. Anyone who can scrape together an entry fee can rope a horse. Due to the number of amateur ropers participating, these terrified animals are too frequently injured or traumatized to the point that they are forever useless as working partners. Too many are ultimately destroyed. I can tell you firsthand that this ranch rodeo practice of horse roping tripping has no place in responsible horse management, or by no stretch of logic is a precursor to acceptable training to ensure the best outcome and life of the animal being roped. Horses are, by nature, fearful, and the experience of being hurt by a lariat makes a lasting impression on them. Their very anatomy puts them at extreme high risk for injury if they are roped and thrown to the ground or accidentally tripped and fall to the ground. The practice of competitive horse tripping benefits only a handful of contestants and it's at huge risk to the well-being of the animal. There are lots of rodeo events left even after horse tripping is taken out. I urge you to vote in favor of Senate Bill 835 to protect these trusting animals and in doing so preserve the integrity of rodeos everywhere. Thank you.
Thank you. Whoever would like to go next?
I'll go. Hi. Madam Chair, Dean Felder and committee members, my name is Sarah Sullen-Eiler. I am a small business owner from Portland, Oregon, and longtime equestrian. I testified in the previous hearing in support of SB 835, and now would like to just read two expert excerpts from a testimony that I turned in to Jennifer from a witness of horse tripping in Cornelius, Oregon. He couldn't be here today because he had to work, unfortunately. So, he says, one of the trip horses was so badly injured on the back legs that it could no longer run. When they injure horses, they put them away and wait until the rodeo is over and have the person who supplies them the horses to get them when no one is around and take them away. The Rorskos got smart after a while and would have injured horses taken away at night while no one was there to see, and that way, if they were turned in, the horses would be gone. Another excerpt. One of the horses that was so badly injured from the ropes on its back legs was going to be taken away. So I wrote my friends up a sales contract and had them buy her for $1 to make it a cash sale. Its back legs were so swollen that you could not tell where the ankles or knees were. The gashes from the ropes were so bad that it had a massive infection and had pus running down its legs. We had our vet, Steve Rindenberg, mm-hmm. from Banks Veterinary in Banks, Oregon, come look at her and treat her. She was lucky and did not ruin her tendons, and with stall rest and medical treatments for several months, she is now a nice-looking horse, except where the scars are on her legs from the ropes. If you would all be so kind as to read that testimony, he discusses exactly how the process worked, where they got the tripping horses from, how they were treated, and threats they received from the barn owners if they told anyone. All the boarders received those threats, not just them. I greatly appreciate that this new bill affirms the right to engage in a rodeo and outlaws horse tripping here in Oregon. I am an avid rodeo fan. Senator Bill Hansel, I would like to thank you personally for your hard work in putting together a bill that protects our horses while keeping the tradition of rodeo intact. So thank you.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm Dr. Barbara Call. I'm a veterinarian. I have sat on the Oregon Veterinary Medical Association Animal Welfare Committee as last year. I also have a rescue. I'm also a 46-year experienced person with horses from training and engaging in several business matters with horses. I have lived in Texas. I have seen abuse and neglect in there, and I can see why they had the bill put in place. I have lived here. I have friends who are ranchers. My husband is a ranching family from South Dakota. He also has relatives that are ranchers in Iowa that raise horses. And so let me begin my testimony. I could say I've only been involved with horses for about 46 years, so hopefully you will understand some of what I have seen here. My personal horses that I've had many of have been everything from BLM, untrained, unhandled, untouched Mustangs that I do not have to rope around the neck to get to stop, nor do I have to rope around the legs to get them to be trained. I have actually been invited by BLM to take some Mustangs to some shows so that they can see what kind of handling creates a nice horse. My horses have not been trapped up in a barn. They have been out on pastures. I don't have to rope them. I call them. They come running from 20 to 50 acres away. As long as they can hear that call, they'll be there. I have been in barrel racing, flags, pole bending, steer dobbing, cattle penning, tried roping. I was a horrible aim, so I stopped that before I got too embarrassed with it. I have done sorting. My horses have carried me over jumps. I have done dressage. I have been in parades. My horses have never once feared me entering their pasture like horses that have been tripped will do. Their surroundings have always been clean and healthy. Anyway, my horses have never carried the mental scars. They've never had their skin purposely torn from their fetlocks. They've never had abrasions or blindness from their heads being pulled through the dirt when they trip and fall. Horses at a dead run who have been hot prodded to get them to move, and then they stop and get their front legs jerked out from underneath them, you can imagine what trauma. Although it's not intentional from prior testimony, it happens. I have seen bones broken. I have seen joints disjointed. As a veterinarian, I have had to treat those. As a veterinarian, I've had to euthanize those. They don't only get the vaqueros one chance to get one of these horses. They get three on the same horse who is running in fear. I have seen up close and personal the trauma, the abuse, the neglect that these horses endure both before competition and after. I work very closely with sheriff's departments. We have had 22 horses taken from people who have raised these animals specifically for horse tripping from 2011 until now on this side of the state. They breed them. They raise them. They don't intend to feed them like they would their horses that they use for the roping, because they need to keep them weak so they're easier to catch, so they fall easier. And if they do, great, more power to the person who is doing the roping, because it's the ego that is benefited, not the animal. The mares and others used for tripping, again, aren't well taken care of. They're only going to go down easier when they're weak. There's no personal agenda for me to support this bill other than fighting to end the suffering, because I have seen both the front end of the sales and the breeding and the back end of having to fix them and euthanize them. When you've lived with animals that have been tortured in this process that I have, you'll understand the need to have this bill pass. There's also just a mention of Oregon and its current animal cruelty laws, and a few of the things that are stated here, and in prior testimony, it's a family event. These people bring their kids to these events. Oregon, ORS 167-320. It is a crime to have any children, witness animal abuse in the state, but they include their family members when these animals get dropped. Animal abuse consists of any physical trauma, means fractures, cuts, punctures, bruises, burns, or other wounds that happen on that animal. I have never seen a horse fall and not become abraded for some reason or another. I have not seen a horse fall and get bruised. I have not seen a horse fall and potentially fracture. They all happen, depending on how the fall occurs. The key points. Horse tripping was brought here by the Spaniards in the 16th century. That existed at the same time as the Catherine wheel, which was a big wooden wheel that people were tied to, and their legs and their arms were beaten until they died. It's the same century when the rack was being used. It's the same century when people were being drawn and quartered. It's the same time frame when people were sawed in half because they committed a crime. But those practices don't exist any longer, just horse tripping. Spain no longer practices horse tripping. They find it horrific. Ema Pizarro is a veterinarian. A friend of mine lives in Cordoba, Spain. Her family is a generational ranching, cattle, horse family. If it were their heritage, they would practice it. In Spain, they do not. They find it horrific. Horse tripping is a direct violation of all of Oregon's animal cruelty laws. It is not a good husbandry practice in the stretch of any imagination. I agree with the veterinarian 100% that if you have a horse that you need to get medicated, it definitely is useful because that is a trained person with a medical knowledge of the physiology of a horse, knowing when to stop pulling on the rope, knowing how much pressure is needed to lay that horse down to treat. That I can understand. I cannot understand an unskilled child, as they say, growing up in this environment to bring these horses down. I don't understand it.
Can I ask you to wrap up?
Yes.
Please, thank you.
Yes, I have sent an email to you with photos of horses that were taken. We had to live with those, heal those. That's on your emails. So when you vote, please put those photos in front of you because that's the reality. Let them speak to you. Know if you do not pass this bill that you are propagating an industry of abuse, not a spectator sport. Please remember your moral compass and, in addition, through multidisciplinary teams around the state, animal abuse is taught and learned. So is child abuse, and they link 100%.
All right, thank you for your testimony. Any questions for any of these ladies? Okay. Thank you very much for your testimony today and for your patience. Anybody else would like to testify on this bill, on Senate Bill 835 today? Okay. All right, seeing none, we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 835. We're going to go ahead and open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 840. So, Beth, if you can tell us what the bill does. We're moving on to water fixtures.
Yes, Madam Chair and committee members, Senate Bill 840, you have a dash one amendment in front of you. It establishes appropriate or new, excuse
wait,
me.
Wait a minute. We'll let everybody clear out. We do have another public hearing going on, so if I can ask you to hold your conversation until you're out in the hall. Thank you.
Go ahead. Stipulates to be effective January 1st, 2016, average amount of water used by certain fixtures and water fixtures. And the dash one amendment you have in front of you has a no revenue impact and a no fiscal impact statement on the bill, and it establishes a new limit of 8.33 liters per minute for an interior faucet other than in lavatories, and changes the word toilets to the word water closets to be used consistently.
Okay, we have Brian Krieg and Jeff Bissonette, and colleagues, this may look familiar. It is because we had to amend the appliance energy efficiency bill because it also had plumbing in it, and apparently for the changes that we needed, the relating clause did not work. So we pulled out the plumbing fixtures, and thus you see now the plumbing fixture bill in front of you. And thank you, Jeff, or whoever would like to go first.
I'll go first. Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jeff Bissonette with the Citizens Utility Board of Oregon, representing residential ratepayers. The chair gave a good overview. One small caution, what we did was there was some language actually from building codes that we wanted to put in 692. That's what did not fit. Right now in 692, the plumbing fixtures that were originally proposed are still there. Over on the House side, those will be coming out and everything will be going into Senate Bill 840. And so that's sort of a preview of things yet to come. And there are, excuse me, there are a few plumbing issues still to work out. I think everybody has is in general agreement of what needs to be done, but we need to do it over on the House side since we've extended the committee administrator's time. We just need to move this bill, but everybody felt comfortable enough to, I think, move on both 840 and 692, and we'll do the wordsmithing and paperwork over on the House side. With that, I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Why don't we hear from Brian first? Brian, thank you for your work on this. I know it's been not an easy road to hoe. Appreciate you working with us.
For the record, Brian Krieg, representing the Plumbing and Mechanical Contractors Association, the Plumbing, Heating, Cooling Contractors Association just today, and then the Plumbing and Manufacturing Plumbing Manufacturers International, who build all the toilets and the fixtures we're talking about. Thank you, Chair Dingfelder, for pulling us together in a work group after we had the discussions on 692. One of the key things we did find was that there were very similar standards and language that already existed in the plumbing code section of the statutes. And so we have gone through the numbers, and we've all agreed on the flow rates on them. These are fitting standards that are happening all over the country. The manufacturers are building the product to these levels, and these are fixtures and with these flow rates and things involved that actually do work. So all of those issues have been taken care of. What we did find is some relating clause issues, and then also having the same numbers in two different places in the statutes would be confusing, and we've all agreed that we need to keep them into the plumbing statutes. And that's what the intent of 840 and the continuation of it will be. And so our organizations urge you to pass the bill with the Dash 1 amendment, and then let us finish the work up on the other side on this one and 692.
Thank you. Thank you both, gentlemen, and everybody who's worked on this. And as you heard, we had a little bit of a relating clause issue, and we will make sure that everything is resolved to comport with the plumbing codes and the codes that are in statute over in the House. Are there any questions for either of these gentlemen?
No.
No flushing or burning there? All right.
Just avoiding those.
Thank you very much.
Yeah. Too easy.
I know. Anybody else would like to testify in Senate Bill 840? Yes, I will. Okay, with that, I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 840. We will go ahead and open up. Okay, we're going to stand at ease for just a minute. I guess we have the amendment, so we need a motion on the dash ones.
Madam Chair, I move the dash ones to Senate Bill 840.
Okay, Senator Hass moves the dash one amendments to Senate Bill 840, and those dash one amendments are dated 4/5/2013. Is there any discussion? Okay, seeing none, are there any objections? With that, seeing none, the amendments are adopted.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 840 as amended to the floor of the Oregon State Senate with a due pass recommendation.
Okay, Senator Hass moves Senate Bill 840 as amended with the dash ones to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Seeing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Senator
Bates? He's excused.
Senator Hample?
Aye.
Senator Hass?
Aye.
Vice Chair Olson?
He's excused.
Senator
Portney?
Yes.
Chair Dingfelder?
Aye. Okay, with that, the motion passes, and I guess the chair will carry this bill because I'm sure there'll be a lot of questions about toilets on the floor. I will close the work session on Senate Bill 840, and we're going to open up our next work session. We're going to open up a work session on Senate Bill 692, and Beth, can you remind the committee about this bill? And we do have... Who is it that's going to come up and just briefly?
Marty
Stipe. Marty? Come on up.
Senate Bill 692, Chair Dingfelder, committee members, there's a dash 4 amendment in your packet with a no revenue impact and a minimal fiscal impact, and it replaces the measure, and I think Marty's going to describe it for you.
Marty, can you briefly describe? This is the energy efficient appliance bill. As I just mentioned, we're pulling out the water fixtures, and then we needed to make sure that all the dates aligned with what was in code, and thank you for working on this. We've been working in a big work group for many weeks. Marty, if you can fill us in.
For the record, my name is Marty Stipe with the Oregon Department of Energy. I'll just step through this dash four very briefly. Sections one and two deal with the definitions that were necessary. The amendments have added some to more closely align with California. Currently, section two still has the plumbing fixtures in there. I believe they were talking about taking care of that.
We will take care of that. Yes, we ran out of time on this side, and we will on the House.
Okay. So section three gets into the energy efficiency standards for televisions and battery chargers. And then the bill addresses actually the different effective dates of the various types of equipment in different sections. Section 4 is also addressing energy efficiency standards, and we have standards in two sections because of different effectivity dates. Sections 5 and 6 deal with the sale of these same pieces of equipment, that in order for these pieces of equipment to be sold in the state of Oregon, they must meet the energy efficiency requirements. Section 7 and 8 deal with these pieces of equipment that in order to be installed, they have to be in accordance with the energy efficiency standards. Section 9 was a reference. Section 10 deals with the effectivity dates. The televisions and battery chargers would, I believe, go into effect with the date of the bill, January 1st, 2014. The plumbing fixtures and there's one type of electric lamp would go into effect January 1st, 2016, and that was the one of the amendments had moved that out, and that's being actually addressed in Senate Bill 840.
Okay. So. Great. Thank you, Marty. Any questions for the department? And I just want to say I appreciate your help. We had the retailers, so I don't see in the room, plumbers, the electrical IBW. We also had the lighting folks, and as of our work group, everybody was fine with these amendments. Brian, did you want to come up and say anything? You're shaking your head? Okay, great. All right. With that, I will take a motion. We are in a work
session.
Madam
Chair, I move to adopt the Dash 4 amendments dated 4-4-2013.
Senator Haas moves to adopt the Dash 4 amendments dated 4-4-2013. Is there any discussion? I just want to say thank you to our committee staff, Beth Riley, who did a phenomenal job at corralling everybody together, so to speak, and making sure that we were all on the same page. Any objections in adopting the amendment? Seeing none, the amendments are adopted.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 692 as amended to the floor of the Oregon State Senate with a do-pass recommendation.
Senator Haas moves Senate Bill 692 as amended with the dash fours. It's been a long day. To the floor with a do-pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Okay, seeing none, the clerk will call the roll. Excused?
Aye.
Aye.
Excused?
Yes.
Aye. With that, the motion carries. I will go ahead and carry the bill since it's a two-parter here. So with that, we will close the work session on Senate Bill 692. We'll go ahead and open up a work session on Senate Bill 830. Beth, you want to? 830. Yep, here's last.
Madam Chair and committee members, Senate Bill 830, for the record, there's a revenue statement issued and the fiscal statement issued that's on OLIS as well as in your packet. And it just heard this. I don't know if you want me to get too in-depth on the bill itself.
And there's no amendments, correct?
Correct.
Okay. I will take a motion.
Chair Dingfelder, I move Senate Bill 830 to the floor with a do-pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
Senator Haas moves Senate Bill 830 to the floor with a do-pass recommendation and then it be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Is there any discussion? Senator Hansel.
Senator, Madam Chair, I'm going to be a no vote on this. A couple of reasons. Number one, the process. We heard testimony from the tribal community. It was my tribe in Eastern Oregon. They've been very proactive in the fish issues, and when they said that they were not collaborated with, they were not a part of the process, that bothers me. And so I, you know, I'm not able to support it. I'm also concerned that the local communities at the mouth of the Columbia are uniformly opposed to this. Again, they felt that, and their suggestion was that it would be good to continue with the deliberations on a more collaborative process. So while I understand there's pros and cons on both sides, I'm concerned about the process, particularly my local tribe, and I'll be a no vote.
Thank you. I did want to ask Department of Fish and Wildlife to come back up and address this issue that was raised, since it is the department that led the process. So if you would like to get a few things on the record, please.
Chair Dingfelder, Ed Bowles, the Fish Division Administrator for Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. I appreciated the Executive Director of the Columbia River Fishery Intertribal Fish Commission, Paul Lumney, testimony. But there were some things that probably would be helpful to clarify. First off, the consultation with the tribes has been extensive. Not only have they been invited testimony at each of the work group meetings that we had, but there is also, we have a State of Oregon representative on the USV Oregon Policy Committee. He has met 5 times with that policy committee since this process began in August to discuss this issue with them. And he has also had 2 specific small work group meetings on this with the tribes through the USV Oregon process. So there has been a lot of opportunity to discuss this with the tribes. I am not characterizing whatsoever that resulted in agreement or concurrence on this path forward, this framework, but the opportunity for discussions have been full.
Director, did you want to add anything?
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Roy Elliker, Director of the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. No, I would not add anything to what Ed Bowles here just stated. We tried very hard to have these discussions with the tribes. Yeah, I would agree. I would not characterize it as somehow that we're going to come to some agreement on this. However, we've had facilitated conversations with all the 4 tribal treaty tribes through Columbia River Intertribal Fish Commission and Director Paul Lumley, both at that level and at USV Oregon.
Chair Dingfelder, also along those lines, it was mentioned that this pathway forward would violate some of the terms of the USV Oregon agreement. We do not believe that is true. In fact, one of the key principles in this framework is to remain consistent with the agreements within the USV Oregon, and we have no intention of violating any of those, including the catch balancing agreement of the harvest sharing. So that is a key foundation for this framework.
Senator, did you have any follow-up questions for the department?
Well, I heard what I heard. I'm sure you heard the same thing. So they certainly feel that they weren't, regardless of whether or not others feel they were. I hope you understand where I'm coming from.
Yes, sir. Thank you. Yes, sir.
Thank you for coming up, gentlemen. Okay, we have a motion on the table, and at this point, I will ask the clerk to call the roll, please.
Senator Bain.
He's excused.
Senator Hansel.
No.
Senator Hatch.
Aye.
Vice Chair Olson.
He's excused.
Senator Courtney.
Yes.
Chair Dingfelder.
Yes. With that, the motion passes, and this is going to Ways and Means, so we will not need a carrier at this time. That'll be a sign down there. We will close the work session on Senate Bill 830. We'll go ahead and open up our last work session on Senate Bill 835.
Madam Chair and committee members, this is the Senate Bill 835, a no revenue impact and a minimal fiscal impact statement. States that conduct hearing of or participation in rodeos is permitted in this state, establishes a person commits offense of equine tripping if they meet certain issues.
Okay, I'll take a motion.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 835 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Haas moves Senate Bill 835 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Senator Hess.
Madam Chair, first of all, thank you for scheduling this. We've had effectively 2 days of public hearings on this, and I thought the debate was respectable. I'm, however, not convinced that horse stripping has any place in our state. And to me, this is still a indefensible practice. And I know we heard from some cowboys today, but the majority of cowboys in this state and in this country have said that they don't approve of this practice. So I hope that we can outlaw it once and for all. I'm very honored to team up with Senator Hansel to put the rodeo component in there. There was a component, the comment made earlier today about, well, this will further the urban divide, and I think just the opposite. He's from the east side of the mountains, and I'm from the west, and we're both joining forces to pass this bill.
Okay, thank you. Senator, would you like to make any comments?
My colleague has said it well. I don't know that I could add anything to it.
Thank you. Okay, with that, no further discussion. The clerk will call the roll.
Senator Bates.
Excused.
Senator Hansel.
Aye.
Senator Hatch.
Aye.
Vice Chair Olson.
Excused.
Senator Courtney.
Yes.
Chair
Dinkfelder. Aye. That the motion passes, and do you guys want to duke it out? Who's going to carry it, or do you want to co-carry it?
That'd be fine.
Okay.
Why don't you
so
open
we will have Senator Hass maybe open and Senator Hansel closed, or vice versa.
Are you okay with that?
And they will co-carry it. With that, we will close the work session on Senate Bill 835. Beth, anything else for the good of the order?
Madam Chair, you cleared your whole agenda today, so you just saw your bills.
Great. With that, we are adjourned. Thank you, gentlemen.